picture. It's all right. Greetings and welcome to the Thursday's session. We're here at... Oops, a bit distorted, that's it. We're here at the ACB 2006 convention in sunny Jacksonville, Florida. I'm Chrissy Cochran, and Marlena Leeward will be along shortly with the programme of what we're going to hear today, I trust. Meanwhile, let's join the entertainment that's on at the moment. Thank you.
Scoggin. Deanna Scoggins.
Thank you. You wore them out yesterday.
Am I up? I don't hear myself. I hope so. Ah, there I am. Oh, gosh, there I am. Live radio. Isn't that great?
Oh, it's wonderful. Boom,
good
boom.
Morning, everyone. Good morning, Boom Boom.
Good morning, Boom Boom.
How are you doing, Boom Boom?
I'm booming along nicely.
All right. Well, we had a lovely dinner last night and in the steakhouse. That was quite good. Yes, I did consider myself very lucky.
You did.
I did indeed. Yes, the first lovely one I've had.
Let us get on.
All right, Boom Boom. Let us get on with it. All right. At 8:30 a.m., we'll have the Pledge of Allegiance, as usual, and this day, it's being done by the children and the teens from the Youth Activity Center, led by Patty Cox, who is the YAC coordinator. YAC, of course, is the Youth Activity Center. So that should be kind of fun to have all the little kids come up and say the Pledge of Allegiance. 8:35, we begin the ACB business, and as we do every day, we will have a different officer preside, and today it will be Treasurer Mike Gaudino. And Mike Gaudino has a big booming voice, so everyone ought to be able to hear him really well. He's from, where's he from? Malvern, New York. 9:15. Let's see, what are we doing? Implementing the Help America Vote Act, the State of the States. That's going to be a panel discussion, and it's very timely. There are many jurisdictions that are now incorporating, because they have to, and because they should, accessible voting machines under the Help America Vote Act. So this will be very, very timely, and the discussion will be led by ACB's Director of Advocacy and Governmental Affairs, Day Al-Mohammed. Artis Bazin, who is a member of the California Secretary of State Voting Systems and Procedures Panel, and also an ACB member, from Burbank, California. Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida. Paul, of course, is past president of ACB. Pat Sheehan from Silver Spring, Maryland, current board member of ACB. And Mike Gaudino, New York State Independent Living Council, and he is the vice chair of that august board, will make up that panel. So that should be a very interesting panel, lots of dynamic folks on there. Then we'll go up to break at 10:15, and at 10:30, now this ought to be a good one, listeners, news from the National Library Service, a Library of Congress digital overview. And that's going to be done by Frank Kurt Silke. director. Sorry, I'm reading with one hand here. Director and Alice Baker, digital contract coordinator. And I bet you there might be a question about web braille. We'll see what happens with that.
Oh, ho! Oh, yes.
Okay. That'll take us up to 11, and then we'll have a wonderful, what I think will be a wonderful session. Louis Braille, A Touch of Genius, by Michael Mellor, Brooklyn, New York. I am reading that book, and if you all haven't had the opportunity yet to take a look at that book, which is provided in Braille, print, and on disc from National Braille Press, I really urge you to do it. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. Lots of really interesting blindness-related history, as well as giving you a whole different perspective into the life of Louis Braille. Okay. And Michael Mellor went to Paris along with Diane Croft from National Braille Press, and they heavily researched the life of Louis Braille. There are excerpts from some of his letters. It's just a wonderful book, so it should be very interesting to listen to Michael Mellor talk about this. Then 11:30, where are we? Notes from a Talking Book Narrator. Jim Zeiger, Talking Book Publishers, Denver, Colorado. Always a popular session. We love to meet those narrators and hear their stories. So we're looking forward to that. And 11:55 will be announcements. And that will take us up to adjournment. So it looks like from 8:35 until 9:15, we will be doing voting and business. So stay tuned, and we'll see what happens today. Right, Boom Boom? Oh, Boom Boom is doing something else. Oh, you gotta love live radio. Let me also remind you that you can reach us by sending an email or an MSN to convention@acbradio.org. That's convention@acbradio.org.
Bum bum.
Hey. All right, let's give them a little bit of house audio, unless you have words of wisdom to share.
I already had my words of wisdom, which is very little, because I have very little wisdom.
Oh, no, I can't even believe that, not for a minute.
Ha! Let's go back to the entertainment before it gets too bad.
I know it.
Thank you. God, did you really?
Is Michael Garrett in the room? Michael Garrett, are you in the room? Two, three, four. One, two, three. Good morning, everybody. I'm just checking my counting ability. Everybody come in and find your seats. We're ready to start.
He wanted me to do that.
Yeah, good. Okay.
Freedom Scientific, a leader in Braille, screen reader, and low vision technology, is proud to participate in the 2006 ACB convention. For details on products and services, visit freedomscientific.com or call 800-444-4443. Freedom Scientific, everything in sight. Merging 30 years of refreshable Braille know-how with 21st century access, Optilec is your source for wireless Braille access to the mainstream devices that you need while increasing your choices to a wide range of applications right at your fingertips.
We're about to start, and everyone is coming and getting to their seats. As you can hear, there's quite a lot of noise. It's filling up rapidly, which is great. You're listening to our coverage of the 45th Convention of the American Council of the Blind from sunny Jacksonville, Florida. Not that I've been seeing the sun much. I've been in a hotel most of the time, but hey. And I hope you enjoy the coverage today.
If he doesn't find him, then we'll just do a moment of silence. I tried to put the finger on hold. He wasn't having any of it. Are you in the room? Shall I recognize you for announcements?
Check. Check, 1, 2. How's that? Check, 1, 2. Check. Hey, hey. Check, 1, 2. Check. Hang on. Check, 1, 2. Hey, hey. You still have level? Okay. How about now? How about now? Check. Check, 1, 2.
Now, this is live radio, folks.
Crackling.
This is
check,
live
1, 2.
Radio.
Hey, hey. Yeah, 1, 2. Check.
I wonder why
check,
people
hey.
Always
yep.
use 1, 2.
Check,
it's interesting,
hey.
That.
Yep, 1, 2.
Check,
hey, hey.
Doing a
yeah.
superb job
check,
of
1, 2. Hey, yep. Check.
Oh,
Marlena just pointed out that live radio also means that you never know when you're on the air, and that's absolutely true. And some funny things have occurred
yep,
that
yep.
way.
Whoa. Hey, 1, 2.
There we go. That's
check
it.
One,
that's
two.
It. They're still going. You're listening to live, really live coverage of the convention from the Hyatt Regency in Jacksonville, Florida, which to my mind is remarkably cold, but hey, that's air conditioning for you.
We'll be starting in just a moment here, but right now we're making a test of the microphone. We want to make sure everything gets recorded perfectly for the ACB convention this year, and we need to be doing some last-minute checking to make sure after our showcase last night that everything is back to normal again, to what we had last night.
Freedom Scientific, a leader in Braille, screen reader, and low vision technology, is proud to participate in the 2006 ACB convention. For details on products and services, visit freedomscientific.com or call 800-444-4443. Freedom Scientific, everything in sight. Merging 30 years of refreshable Braille know-how with 21st century access, Optilec is your source for wireless Braille access to the mainstream devices that you need, while increasing your choices to a wide range of applications right at your fingertips. Learn more about Optilec's wireless Braille assistance at the ACB convention in Jacksonville or visit Optilec.com. That's OPTELEC.com. Serotech, manufacturers of Freedom Box products and system access, is proud to be a partner at the 2006 ACB National Convention. More information on Serotech products and services is available at www.freedombox.info or by calling toll-free 866-202-0520 in the U.S. Serotech, providing you accessibility anywhere.
You're listening to live coverage of the 45th Annual ACB Convention from Jacksonville, Florida. Now, here are your hosts, Chrissy Cochran and Marlena Lieberg.
Here we are indeed at the convention. They're still doing some tests. There are people running about all over the place like headless chickens, sorting out microphones and think, bang, bang, there they are. But they want to get a good recording
of the broadcast here.
I'll just put it up slightly so you can hear what it's actually doing. But they want to get a good recording, and we want to get a good feed to you. So we'll put up with all this.
At least we'll try.
We'll put up. Yeah, we can.
Yes.
We can always go to music if it goes on for an hour. But hey,
or we can just.
Or we can rabbit
we
and
can
burble.
We can sit here and narrate. And,
we can. Yes, we can indeed. Yes. Go ahead.
Can I just tell everybody how strange it is because I have two sets of headphones on.
She's and, odd. Oops. She's odd like that.
I am. And so in one set, I have the house audio, which is, you know, live, Chrissy and me talking and da-da-da. And the other set is the stream, which is Chrissy and me talking, but it's about, what, 15, 20 seconds later.
Oh, easily that. I'd like to say that we have had some lovely feedback about the coverage.
Yes.
And many, many thanks to all of you for that.
And we so appreciate it.
We do,
that.
Actually. Too.
And, you know, someone else we need to... Oh, here we are. Oh. Here we are.
Are we
here?
Yeah. Welcome to the Wednesday session of the 45th Annual Convention of the American Council of the Blind. Pledge. Let's begin by giving a great thank you to our entertainment for this morning, Deanna Scoggins from Louisville, Kentucky. Now, you guys, we have got a whole bunch of kids up here on stage. The full contingent that's woken up from being wore out yesterday from the Youth Activity Center. With the lady who manages them all day, every day, that would exhaust me for a month. They're here to give the Pledge of Allegiance. If you'll all please rise, I'm going to take the mic and give it to Patty Cox.
Put your hand. Okay. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Squishy.
Thank you, Yak. You kids are great, and you sure have a lot of energy for this hour of the morning. For the invocation this morning, it gives me pleasure to introduce one of our members, a member of the board of directors, to lead us in prayer, ladies and gentlemen, from Talladega, Alabama, Mr. David Trott.
Let us pray. Dear Lord, we come to you this morning in thanks. We thank you for the many blessings that you've given us over the past few years and the accomplishments you have allowed us to make. Lord, we ask you to help us to move forward, to do the right thing to you and honor you in the decisions that we make and the paths that we take. Lord, as we come through this week, about half through, we ask you to bless the rest of our convention and us as we travel to our separate homes. We ask all of this in the holy name. Amen.
Thank you, David. I will now recognize the chair of the nominations committee to bring the report of that committee before the body. Ladies and gentlemen, from the great state of Massachusetts, Judy Cannon.
Good morning, everyone. I want to thank everybody on the committee for meeting again. We had a very productive meeting, a very long meeting. And here is our report. For the four-year board of director positions, I will report them in the order in which they came out of committee. Jeff Tom, California, Principal Legislative Counsel for the state. Ray Campbell, Illinois, works in information technology for the Chicago Lighthouse. Brenda Dillon, Tennessee, self-employed. Billie Jean Keefe, Virginia, she is an editor. Carla Rushival, Kentucky, teacher. For the two-year director position to fill a vacancy, Carol Ann Ewing, Nevada, she is a resource teacher. There are three positions that we will deal with for the Board of Publications. Deanna Quietwater Noriega, Chicago. She is a freelance writer and an entrepreneur. Cindy Van Winkle from Washington State. She is a paraeducator. Ken Stewart is from New York, and he is an education mediator. Mr. President, that is the slate. And good luck to everybody on Friday morning. Thank you.
Come on, girls. Thank you very much, Judy. Thank you, committee, for a job doubly well done.
Mr. Chairman, John Hannigan from Colorado. I'd like to make a minor correction to the slate that was just read. Deanna okay. Noriega is from Colorado. Not Chicago.
Okay.
Thank you.
Judy thought she said Colorado. She meant to, but thank you. Thank you for the clarification, John. Okay, a couple of announcements. I would like to remind people that in the exhibit hall is our very own ACB store with many great items to sell to you. We'd love you to come. See what ACB has to offer with our logo on it. We also have electronics. We have software that's of special merit to blind people. Please, in your travels around the exhibit hall today, don't forget to stop and shop at the ACB store. Thank you. Anybody know the booth number?
56 and 57.
56 and 57. 56 and 57. Okay. I will now recognize, if you're ready, Carla, I'll recognize you for some announcements. Or if you're not ready, we can come back to you after a bit.
Mr. President?
Who seeks the floor?
This is Julie Dawson, first-timer from Louisiana, respectfully requesting the privilege, point of privilege.
Yeah.
I just wanted to take a few moments to say how blessed I am to be here. I want to thank Bonnie and Terry Commerdell, Kim and Tom Venable, who brought me up here, and they all made it possible for me to come. Dan and Paula Marshall, who I'm rooming with, and they're putting up with me. And all the people in Louisiana who voted for me and showed trust in me and faith in me for me to be here. I've been an NFB member for 30 years, and I'm here now, and it's the right place for me to be. I found...
Welcome. We're delighted to have you.
I know that a lot of us have walked that road, and... there's a great deal of acceptance and love and decency and kindness here that I've never found anywhere else. And I also want to thank MJ Schmidt for her patience with all my questions and the Millimans. And Ed Bradley, I'll still come and find you, but you got to be careful how you help me adjust, you know, even though you know what happened to the Sooners and LSU Tigers a couple years ago. And I'll shut up. Thank y'all for having me.
Okay, thank you. I'll now recognize Sheila Styron, the president of Guide Dog Users International, for an announcement.
Thank you, Chris. GDUI is holding its first ever fundraiser auction. We'd love you all to come this afternoon at the Daytona Room at 2:15. I want you to raise your paws for a great cause. HumanWare has donated a trekker. We have an eclipse rider. We have open book, a lot of wonderful jewelry and other items. And we have a generously donated gift pack from of barbecue from Kansas City, gift item worth $250 that they'll ship to you, enough to feed 14 people. So we all invite you to come to our auction this afternoon, have a good time, and raise some funds for GDUI. Enjoy the rest of the convention. Thank you.
Mr. President, Steve Harrison from Maryland.
Yes, Steve.
Yes, the Maryland delegation is sponsoring a 50-50 raffle for the Central Maryland chapter, and what we're doing is raising funds for chapter endeavors, and you can see Ruth Harrison here in the convention today, tomorrow, and Friday between now and when sessions close. And each ticket is $1, and it goes, like I said, to the Central Maryland chapter.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I will now recognize the chair of the Constitution and Bylaws Committee to bring forward new amendments. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Ray Campbell.
Okay. Well, good morning, everyone. I thank you for your indulgence here this morning. And just a couple things before I begin. I'm kind of bouncing up and down. There we go. One word about the copies. We have made copies of amendments that we have read available out at the information desk. We only made 50 of each Braille and large print. So what we'd prefer is to take one per delegation. We may not have made that clear. So if you have them and you finish with them, please return them to the information desk so that others can read and study the amendments. It's very important that we all know what we're doing as far as amending the Constitution, and we want to make sure that everybody gets an opportunity to read the amendments, discuss them amongst your delegation, and be prepared to vote on them later on in the week. We're going to bring forward three first readings this morning, and if we have some time, then we'll try to vote on one or two as well. We'll see what Chris is going to let us do up here. This amendment that I'm about to read, you do not have copies of this available yet. As soon as I get off stage and get down, I will get those, get that ready and run it down to the press room. So, amendment 0603. Oops, it would help if I opened the file, actually, guys. Amendment 0604, submitted by Jim Urock. Article 3, it amends Article 3, Section C, voting. Modify the seventh sentence of this section, that's seventh as in number seven, by replacing 25 with 50. Current wording, C, voting. Each voting member attending an annual convention shall be entitled to one vote. In addition, official delegates from affiliates shall cast the number of votes to which their organization is entitled as provided in the bylaws. Voting on all issues at annual conventions shall be conducted in one of two manners. Okay. Voice vote, by which the presiding officer calls for the oral ayes and then for the oral nays, or a record vote. A record vote shall be composed of two distinct components: a standing vote, by which the individual votes of certified voting members are count are taken, and a roll call of affiliates, by which official affiliate delegates shall announce the votes of their respective organizations. Elections where there are contests of officers, directors, and members of the Board of Publications must be conducted by record vote. If a voice vote on any issue in the opinion of the presiding officer is too close to determine the result, the presiding officer shall have the discretion to order a record vote on the issue. A record vote on any issue shall also be ordered by the presiding officer if any 25 certified voting members and or members at large identify themselves from the floor of the convention and request a record vote. The proposed wording, C, voting. Each voting member attending an annual convention shall be entitled to one vote. In addition, official delegates from affiliates shall cast the number of votes to which their organization is entitled as provided in the bylaws. Voting on all issues at annual conventions shall be conducted in one of two manners: voice vote, by which the presiding officer calls for the oral ayes and then for the oral nays, or record vote. A record vote shall be composed of two distinct components: a standing vote, by which the individual votes of certified voting members are taken, and a roll call of affiliates, by which the official affiliate delegates shall announce the votes of their respective organizations. Elections where there are contests of officers, directors, and members of the Board of Publications must be conducted by record vote. If a voice vote on any issue in the opinion of the presiding officer is too close to determine the result, the presiding officer shall have the discretion to order a record vote on the issue. A record vote on any issue shall also be ordered by the presiding officer if any 50 certified voting members and or members at large identify themselves from the floor of the convention and request a record vote. That is that one. Okay, bring up another one here. Okay, we're going to go to Amendment 0608. This is submitted by Ken Stewart. We're going to amend Article 4, Section K, by striking out all of the current text in the section and inserting the following. It shall be the affirmative obligation of every candidate for any elective office to disclose all associations, whether volunteer, employment, or contractual, with any outside organization serving or representing people who are blind. Any conflict of interest or appearance of conflict of interest shall be sufficient to require a disclosure. The disclosures shall be announced along with the candidate's state of residence, to the convention by the person making the nomination, either on behalf of the nominating committee or from the floor. Current wording of K, the nominating committee or the chair shall announce to the convention the place of residence, the employer, and the type of gainful employment of any nominee for elective office in this organization. Proposed wording, it shall be the affirmative obligation of every candidate for any elective office to disclose all associations, whether volunteer, employment, or contractual, with any outside organization serving or representing people who are blind. Any conflict of interest or appearance of conflict of interest shall be sufficient to require a disclosure. The disclosures shall be announced along with the candidate's state of residence to the convention by the person making the nomination, either on behalf of the nominating committee or from the floor. That's that one. And let's see. My fingers are not working this morning here. So, okay. Amendment 0605, submitted by Charlie Hodge. Amend Article 5, Section C, second sentence, by striking out the word chair and replacing it with the word chairperson. Current wording, the Board of Directors is hereby authorized to establish an executive committee consisting of 5 members selected and constituted in the following manner. 2 members shall be elected by and from among the 10 directors. 2 members shall be elected by and from among the 5 officers and the immediate past president. The president shall serve as chair. Proposed wording. The Board of Directors is hereby authorized to establish an executive committee consisting of 5 members selected and constituted in the following manner. 2 members shall be elected by and from among the 10 directors. 2 members shall be elected by and from among the 5 officers and the immediate past president. The president shall serve as chairperson. Proviso, if the above amendment is adopted, the secretary, in consultation with the chairperson of the Constitution and Bylaws Committee and the executive director, is hereby authorized to insert the word chairperson in place of the word chair wherever the latter word is found to occur throughout the Constitution and bylaws, and to correct article and section designations, punctuation, and cross-references, and to make such other technical and conforming changes as may be necessary to reflect the intent of the members in convention assembled in relation to achieving unanimity of consistency in the usage of and conformity in terminology utilized throughout the ACB Constitution and bylaws, while at the same time not altering the substantive meaning of or the intent underlying the numerous provisions envisioned to be altered throughout the ACB Constitution and bylaws pursuant to the insertion and alteration authority granted herein to the Secretary. Okay, that's the 3 first readings. Chris, do we want to try voting one? No. We're just conferring up here, folks. So,
I was just debating in my mind whether or not
we have
the one we have to vote on might or might not be controversial. We do have a wonderful agenda this morning. I don't want to disrupt it too much, but Ray, let's give it a try.
Okay. Well,
we've got another 3 or 4
minutes.
We're
always willing to try things in ACB. Let's make this no exception. Here we go. If I could. Okay. This one's a fairly short one, so I'll take it. Amendment 0602, submitted by Sheila Styron, add the following sentence to the end of Article 3, Section B, Subsection 1 of the Constitution. Quote, Neither currently affiliated organizations nor those seeking affiliation with this organization shall exclude members based solely on their membership in another consumer organization of the blind. Current wording. 1. Any organization having at least 25 voting members, the majority of whom are blind, may apply for affiliation with this organization. Such application must be approved by a majority of the board of directors. To remain in good standing, an affiliate shall maintain a membership of at least 13, a majority of whom are blind. Proposed wording, 1. Any organization having at least 25 voting members, the majority of whom are blind, may apply for affiliation with this organization. Such application must be approved by a majority of the board of directors. To remain in good standing, an affiliate shall maintain a membership of at least 13, a majority of whom are blind. Neither currently affiliated organizations nor those seeking affiliation with this organization shall exclude members based solely on their membership in another consumer organization of the blind. The Constitution and Bylaws Committee recommends a do pass.
You've heard the recommendation of the committee. That is the motion on the floor. Is there discussion? Does everybody understand the intent of this amendment? Hearing no calls for the floor. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no.
No.
I think the ayes have it.
Chair rules that the motion carries.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Ray. That will conclude the business portion of the meeting this morning.
Mr. President, this is Frank Welty.
Yes, Frank, you're recognized.
I rise to a point of personal privilege. I just want to remind the membership that this afternoon at 1:30 p.m. in River Terrace 2, I believe is the room, the BITS will be having our final program session, which will feature a presentation from Gary Moulton of Microsoft talking about the new Windows Vista operating systems. You won't want to miss that.
Thank you very much. Carla, do you have announcements for us? All right. I'll recognize Carla Rushable for the purpose of making announcements.
Thank you, Mr. President. I have a list, as you might imagine, of caucuses for the next couple of days, and I'm sure that will grow. The Midwest Caucus will be held today in the Orlando Room. Midwest at 5 p.m. in the Orlando Room. I can't read or talk this morning. The Florida Council of the Blind will caucus tomorrow at 12:30 in Orlando. The New England Caucus will be held at 12:30 tomorrow in City Terrace 12. GDUI's caucus will be tomorrow afternoon at 2:45 in River 2, their usual meeting room. The Western States caucus will be Thursday tomorrow at 4:30 p.m. in City Terrace 9. The Missouri Council will caucus tomorrow at 5 p.m. in City 4. The Mid-South caucus is tomorrow at 5 p.m. in Orlando. Focus groups for today are Optilec at 1:30 and 3:30 in City 6 and Freedom Box at 2:30 and 4 in City 4. Room changes. The Red Hat Luncheon has more red hats than were anticipated, which is a wonderful thing. And so at 12:30 today, the Red Hat Luncheon will move to River Terrace 1. River Terrace 1. Sorry for the room change, but we wanted to be able to fit everybody in. And so that's a great thing. Blind and visually impaired Masons are invited to explore the formation of an ACB affiliate for people who are members of the Masonic Lodge. If you are interested, please attend a meeting from 2 to 4 p.m. this afternoon in the St. John's Room. ACB Cafe stays open to 7:30 this evening. There are two boxes at the information desk, and Pam Shaw invites you to fill them both. The first one, box number one, is a suggestion box. Please write any suggestions and ideas that you have to help us make this a bigger and better convention in future years. You can write them in Braille or print and drop them in the suggestion box. We really do appreciate your ideas, and I can tell you from my own personal point of view that oftentimes some of the changes that are made in this convention come from suggestions from individuals, so please pass along those ideas. Box number two is for your convention badges. Before you leave this convention, whenever you're ready to leave, whether it be on Friday or Saturday or today or tomorrow, please return your badge to the box, box number two, at the information desk so that we can recycle it. These badges cost a considerable amount of money, and every badge that you return is a cost savings for ACB. And I would like to recognize Ron Milliman for an announcement. I think he has good things to say about MMS, don't you, Ron?
I wonder how she guessed that. Good morning, everyone. And I'll tell you what, this is an incredibly super fantastic convention we're having. Everybody's having a lot of fun. And I want to commend the FIA people last night. Wow, what a job they did. That was super. That was fantastic. Yeah. Anyway, I also want to thank everyone that has signed up for the MMS program. The monthly monetary support program is doing very, very well during the convention. And just to give you a little bit of a hint, yesterday alone, annualized contributions came up to $1,740. So, and we're anticipating more today. So if the forms are available in the registration office, they're available from myself, Ron Milliman, or from Frank Welty, or from Ed Bradley. Kenny Maddox can help you with them. Carol Ewing can help you with them. Any number of us can help you if you need assistance filling them out. We're going to be up in the President's Suite this afternoon from 2:30 to 4. And remember, Miss Patty's up there presiding over everything, and she's anxious to find a new home. So everybody that registers this month, or not this month, this week in convention week, will be in put into a drawing for Miss Patty. And that's kind of fun and exciting, too. So I hope to see you all this afternoon. Procrastination time is over with.
Mr. President?
Carla, are you done?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. President.
All right. Thank you. I recognize Marlena Lieberg.
Thank you. We just want to remind everyone, if you want to win that lifetime subscription to Freedom Box and you're going to be at the banquet, come to ACBRI booth in the exhibit area with your name, phone number, and email address in print or Braille, and you too could win. Thank you, and good morning, world.
Good morning. I now am very pleased to introduce to you the presiding officer of the day, the Treasurer of the American Council of the Blind from the great state of New York. Ladies and gentlemen, join me, please, in welcoming Mr. Mike Godino.
Thank you, Mr. President. Good morning, ACB. This is the first time I'm up here as the Treasurer, and just a little bit nervous, so if you can deal with me. And this little accent that everybody tells me I have when I come to convention, but none of my neighbors complain about it. We have a great program today, but before we get into that, I just would like to explain to you a little bit about what I have been doing and some of the committees that I work on with ACB. I have the pleasure to work with quite a few committees, and I've asked the president to remove some of them from my expertise because I'm not really expert in certain committees such as Women's Concerns. but I was honored to be given the liaison position. My microphone is moving. By the president to Women's Concerns, and I'd like to just thank them for all the work they're doing here at convention, and if you can, please join them in the work that they are doing for the women of America and ACB. Thank you. The Multicultural Committee met while here at convention, and they would just like to bring to the membership of ACB that they would like to host some program at the 07 convention. They'd like your assistance with that. They'd also like you as the affiliates and the leaders of ACB to reach out to your membership and begin recruiting from and reaching out to the minority communities within your areas and bringing more minorities to ACB to join us in reaching out to people who are blind and moving our agenda forward throughout the year. I have been elected to the ACBES board, and we are working hard at trying to get that back up to where it was in the past and make ACBES giving them the ability to do what they have to do for us. As many of us know, we all rely on ACBES to provide us the funds we need to function as an organization, and the board of directors of ACBES is working hard to make sure that happens. But I promised Dennis that when I got up here, I would let him give away a couple of door prizes. So why don't we just start out with one for now and see if we can't make everybody happy. And I'd like to be your friend. So if you have any questions or you have trouble understanding me, just let me know, and I'll work hard to make that change. Thank you. Dennis? Excuse me? Doug. Oh, I'm sorry. Doug. Are you ready?
I will be in a second.
Are you in here? No, I guess not. So we're going to have to wait on that. It's very difficult to hear up here.
I just had to get the microphone.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Our first door prize is from Daimer Travel. It's a wonderful tote bag full of a carnival hat, a T-shirt, and a towel, and $20 from the Clay Council of the Blind. And I'll pull a card out. Roy Ward of Richmond, Virginia. Is Roy here? All right, raise your hand and Jay will deliver.
He's not here.
Oh, he's not here. Okay. Then, okay, we'll pull a second one. Okay, Dan Rawlings of San Rafael, California. Okay, we'll try number three. Dina Polston of Muncie, Indiana. Dina here?
He's still upstairs. Try again. Boy.
Ah, this one I recognize. Janine Stanley of Columbus, Ohio.
But she's not here?
Janine, shame on you. Okay. You snooze, you lose. Peter Ulchel of Washington, D.C. Boy,
saying we started too early this morning.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Karen Hollins, Kansas City, Missouri.
Is she
here?
Oh.
Well, that's right.
Now I know why we wait.
Oh, here's another one I recognize. David Liu of Morristown, New Jersey.
Nope.
All right, let's pick another spot and see what I come here. Here's a repeat. Ron Eller, Hudson, North Carolina. How about if I pull somebody who's here?
That would be nice.
Dan Sipple, Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
Hearing no hollers.
No. One of these states have to have somebody here.
Oh, hold on. Is he here?
Is he here?
Okay.
One.
He is here.
Is he here? Where is he?
Holler, feller.
Please stand up.
If you're here, yell.
I'm here. Okay, I heard.
No,
I heard.
Dan.
Okay. Congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to move on to something that's a little bit more productive.
I will go get it.
We can't give them away this morning. I would like to introduce our Directory of Advocacy and Governmental Affairs, Day Al-Mohammed, to introduce her panel on an issue that I'm very passionate about, the Help America Vote Act. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike. I know a lot of people have hopefully gotten the legislative updates and have at least an idea of what's going on in Washington, D.C., and that the National Office works very hard to represent the issues for people who are blind and visually impaired to Congress. Now, one of the things, if you've ever heard me speak, that I talk a lot about is that Congress listens to three things. One is money. Two is media attention. And the third is numbers, as in voting numbers. I think we were all aware this last year when there were the protests by the Latino and the Hispanic community. They had them on the wall. They had them in cities all across the country. And what happens afterwards is Congress starts listening to them because they go, oh, look, votes. And so I know a lot of people go, why should I care about voting? Well, this is where I'm going to say you need to care about voting because it makes it a lot easier to get your message across to Congress when I can say there are this many people who are not going to vote for you unless you support these issues. One of the things that we've worked on at the federal level was some of the standards for the voting machine systems. However, one of the things I also said at this last year's seminar is that at this point in time, voting issues are going state by state, because states have enacted their own laws, because, you know, they're not going to wait for the federal government. And so one of the things I wanted to have here at convention is a panel made up of some different states that are having some pretty dramatic changes in the way voting is done and some of the battles they're having. That way affiliates as well as members can see this is what's going on, this is how we're combating it, and this is how we can trade information to make this work better. We actually have a full hour for this, I think, so I'm actually kind of pleased about that. So we have representatives from California, which has been in some long-term discussions with the Secretary of State on voting issues. New York, which I've heard has gotten very contentious with regard to the issues. Maryland, which in the past, the state of Maryland said, you know what, we're doing a great job for people who are blind and visually impaired. And so now the question is, well, is that true? And then, of course, you know, I'd be remiss if we did not include our host state, Florida. So, you know, I'm sure I would hear all about that. So I think what I will probably like to start with would be California, since they've been at it the longest. and ask Artist Bazin if she'd be willing to tell us what's going on there.
Thank you. Is it on? Okay. In California, I was asked by the Secretary of State, Shelley, to serve on the first advisory board to set up the regulations and do the state plan for the state of California 3 years ago. And when I was on that advisory committee, of course, I pushed accessibility all the way. And unfortunately, Secretary of State Shelley was not as open to accessibility. I mean, he kept saying he was, but all of his decisions weren't necessarily in our best interest. However, the state plan did have a lot of accessibility things in it, and they did provide for an accessibility committee, of which I was appointed to that ongoing accessibility committee once the state plan was implemented. After that time, we've done more and more work with accessibility in the voting area since then, and it's gotten much, much better. In fact, they've even enacted laws in California making it that they have to have accessible voting machines, accessible everything in the voting area. But they also passed a law in California to have the fact that you have to have a paper ballot that people can read after they've voted to make sure that what they want is passed. Well, that has made it extremely hard to make everything accessible. So we've been having ongoing efforts to, by the Accessibility Committee, to make sure that things are accessible. In California, what has happened is each county is allowed to choose its own voting machine. And the downside of that is that you have to deal with accessibility committees throughout the whole state of California. And even though the statewide committee on accessibility has said that we'd like each county to do certain standards, it's up to those counties to follow them. And if those counties do not have an accessibility committee that's working with their county administration, then things don't necessarily get done. Some of the counties have been really good about working with our community on accessibility, and some counties have not. We had several counties that did not have accessible systems in our primary in June. In fact, there's a lawsuit by some people with disabilities in those counties because of the fact there were not accessible machines. The other thing that has happened is that not all machines are accessible to all people with disabilities. We have some machines, for example, the Diebold touchscreen was very accessible to all people with disabilities until it required us to have the paper verification. And at that point in time, it was not accessible any longer to totally blind persons. The verification was not accessible because it's put on a roll afterwards, and all they do is read through the ballot again of what you've done on the screen, so you don't actually, it's not read off the paper. The AutoMark system has been really good for people who are blind because you can put your ballot back in and it'll read it back off to you. But for other people with disabilities, there's been some issues with them being able to pull the ballot out, put it into a privacy sleeve. And even though it does it partially automatically, it doesn't do it fully automatically. And it's been difficult for some other people with disabilities to be able to use that machine. They've tried to put in a vote pad system in some counties, and so far it has not been certified. And our accessibility committee is working hard to not let it get certified, because even though if you're a very adept blind person, you probably could handle it, but unfortunately for newly blinded people or anybody with dexterity issues, you have to count the holes over and mark it, and then the only way to verify it is to use a sensor to see if you can find where you marked. And it's very limiting. I mean, you really have to be good with your tactical skills in order to be able to use that system effectively. But I could go on and on with all the different systems. Another thing we've been working on is the procedures and the as far as getting materials accessible to all people. One of the problems we find is continually we get complaints from people who don't get it on cassette tape, who don't know where they can get the materials on cassette tape. And even though there are links on the Secretary of State's website, there are numbers to call, not every a person is always aware of those. And so that's an ongoing effort. Another thing we find constantly is at the poll sites, there is never enough training for disability awareness. No matter what kind of training there is, it seems like we get constant complaints from people that they're not being assisted properly, or they're told that they can't be helped, or the poll workers just are not getting enough training. So we're also stressing that in our state. So we need a lot more work, and we need more of you to be willing to serve on your advisory councils in your counties. And, of course, I'm speaking particularly to Californians, but I think that's across the country, is you need to volunteer to work with your county election officials, because if we don't get enough participation from people with disability, they don't know your concerns. So you need to constantly be advocating for that. So I'll let the next person go.
The speakers are going to come in. I thought, well, why don't I do it as in the length of time we've been working on the issue? Well, like, that's not going to be true, because a lot of affiliates and states have been working on it a lot longer, as have a lot of individuals. So I think what I'm going to do is try and move it towards as things get more contentious, and then try to finish with where the problem was supposedly solved but might not be. So I think next in contentious line would be Florida, if I remember correctly.
Well, Florida is sort of interesting. Oh, hello. Florida is sort of interesting, because we kind of feature the best of times and the worst of times. And I think Day is right. We're coming to the place where at least some of our problems are being solved. But to try to give you a little bit of historical background, Florida actually, in spite of all of you rude people out there who are laughing about the Chad election of 2000 and doing all those things, was among the very first state to develop and implement a plan that actually spoke to dealing with electoral issues. Florida passed its own law sooner than virtually any other law did, and set deadlines that counties had to meet in terms of accessible voting machines, regardless of whether funds were available through HAVA or not. And many of the counties in Florida actually did meet those deadlines. They were extended to a degree. There are four or five problems that I think it's worth highlighting in Florida to try to bring out some of the issues. The first thing is, we got accessible voting in Florida because people with disabilities demanded it. People like Jim Crott and Gail Krause and Doug Hall and a number of other folks actually served on committees that looked at machines, that evaluated machines, that demanded that standards be set appropriately when public hearings were held, that demanded to be a part of the process once a task force was set up. And even though the first task force on voting had already essentially been adopted by the state of Florida, it was our pushiness, and a pushiness that, by the way, combined the efforts of ACB and NFB, that led to the creation of a subsidiary task force on disability issues, and that led to the amendment of the language of the Florida bill. So, bottom line, action helps. Okay. Number two, the only way that you get effective voting systems in counties is by actively participating in county efforts. Voting is a local issue, and it doesn't happen unless there are people who are pretty closely involved. We did training through the Florida Council of the Blind on accessible voting, and we encouraged people to become involved at the county level and in becoming active participants in the choice of machines. However, point three,
Sometimes it doesn't matter. In Daytona Beach, which was kind of the low water mark in the state of Florida, we found ourselves in a place where, in spite of probably the most active and reasonably united disability caucus in the whole state, the Daytona Beach or the Volusia County folks did not meet, and this happened last year, did not meet the timelines for accessible voting, and in fact had not chosen a machine and determined that they weren't going to choose a machine. It got worse. It went to court, and the initial decision was that they didn't have to. And then it went to a court of appeals, and their decision was that we didn't have to. Bad court decisions and essentially overturned at the federal level to a great extent. However, bottom line is they still had deadlines to meet both for HAVA and for Florida, which they eventually did meet with accessible machines. And now what we can essentially say in Florida is, in spite of the ups and downs and in spite of the changes, we are in a situation where we are probably one of the very few states where every single one of our 67 counties has accessible voting machines in every precinct. And that happened because we didn't wait for HAVA. We demanded that the state legislature take a proactive approach and that they work very hard to assure that machines are accessible. I have two other things that I want to say, and then I'll pass it on to the next person. The first thing that I want to say is an area that we sometimes ignore is the process of machine certification. It is really crucial that people recognize that even though it seems as if state certification approaches are inappropriate and are long and are holding back the process of accessible voting, the fact is that you are much more likely to end up with machines that meet all of the standards that are set to assure that everybody is happy with the machine that you select if your certification standards are pretty high, as they are in Florida. And the last thing that I want to say is Florida, perhaps because of the year 2000, is also one of the hotbeds of activity for the paper ballot people. And particularly in my county, which is the county of Miami-Dade in the city of Miami, we have an extremely strong coalition for paper ballot. For those of you who are not familiar with what all of this means, in very simple terms, they're suggesting that it isn't sufficient to have voting machines that are infallible. What we need to have is the capacity to build a paper audit trail that will assure that what we end up having is the capacity to check not only with machines, but with hard copies. And their contention is that there is sufficient machine error to justify using a paper ballot as an absolute and final measure. Well, they are gaining strength. We overcame an initial effort to absolutely replace all of the machines we had with an entirely different set of machines. And the machines we had were good touchscreen machines that cost the county $24.5 million. But we almost ended up completely replacing them. We've worked pretty closely with the paper ballot people to try to maintain dialogue and to try to say that we must build a joint activity. That activity involves two things. It involves recognizing the need for an audit, but saying categorically that no matter what you do, in order to create an audit trail, you cannot, must not, and we will not allow you to sacrifice accessible private voting to get there. And if you're going to create a paper trail, then you're going to have to create a paper trail that works for us who are blind, too. So finally, Florida is essentially a state where we've made an immense amount of progress, where because of hard work of disabled people working together, a lot's been accomplished. But we're also a state that must remain constantly vigilant, because we're a state where discrimination against black voters, discrimination against registering disabled voters, and a whole range of other issues are high on the list of crimes. So when we're thinking about accessible voting, we've also got to remember that voter registration is another component where there is an extreme danger of people who want less government working to ensure that people can't get registered. Thanks.
And next on the list, obviously I'm going to keep things short then, would be Mike Godino for New York.
Well, in contrast to Florida, can you say dysfunction?
Dysfunction.
New York State has been working, and I have been working as an advocate in New York State for the American Council of the Blind of New York to ensure that people who are blind can vote. In 1992, when I became actively blind and started to get involved with the ACB of Long Island, I asked the question, well, how do we vote? And I was told then, well, don't worry about that. We'll figure that out later. It came 2002, and we have the Help America Vote Act, and then was my chance, the opportunity for us to change the means of voting in New York State so that I could cast a private independent ballot. Unfortunately, New York State in 1890 was ahead of the curve when they introduced what was called and known as the full-face ballot. And in our election law, it states that a voter must have the ability to view the ballot, all candidates, all races, and all referendum within a single frame of the ballot, which equates to a full-face ballot. That means our machines are about 4 feet wide and 3 feet tall, and we get to see everything all at once. When you can't see, that becomes a major problem. With the voting machines that are coming up, we told them they must be accessible, and it took 2 years for the New York State Legislature, the most dysfunctional in the nation, to introduce a law that they said was going to make voting accessible to people with disabilities. Unfortunately, they did not do away with this ballot, and at the time, none of the full-face machines were accessible. We are the only state in the nation that retains that full-face ballot requirement. It cannot be made accessible by means of scrolling menus, because we cannot use those page-turning machines such as the Diebold and the Dell machine and all the other machines that are circulating around the country as accessible machines. Well, that dysfunctional New York State legislature decided that in this law they were also going to require the voter verifiable permanent paper record, which is nothing but the paper audit trail. And we told them that they couldn't do that because paper trails are not accessible to people who are blind. And what the machine vendors convinced the legislature of, that the paper was accessible because the machine that nobody else trusted and they wanted to put the paper on would read the paper back to the blind voter, so they can indeed have an accessible paper trail. And we told them that that will not work, because we must have that same data stream that all other voters are using, which is the paper. So if you're going to make sure that we have to have this paper, we want to make sure that that paper is accessible to us as blind voters. Another thing that happened in New York State because of their lackluster of implementation was DOJ decided that they were going to make a spectacle of New York State by suing New York State to implement the Help America Vote Act, because we really were the last state in the union to come up with a law that was going to implement that in New York State. So DOJ came in, and we thought that this was going to fix everything for us, and because DOJ was suing New York State for lack of implementation, that we were going to soon have something. And last year, when the suit was announced, it wasn't even last year. Well, I guess it was back in November.
we looked forward to this. I became a plaintiff in that lawsuit as a personal plaintiff, hoping that my name on the lawsuit, along with a few other people with disabilities, would be able to make sure that our issues were met. Well, it went to federal court, and that day in federal court, I met with the DOJ attorneys, and they told me that, you know, sometimes we have to give up something to get something else. And what they wanted to give up was access for me as a blind person. And I told them that that was unacceptable, and I needed to be able to vote privately and independently with my sighted peers, and that a paper trail is not accessible at this point in time, and we needed to make sure that all aspects of voting were equally accessible because they are in the law. And they didn't want to hear that. They just wanted dates. They wanted dates and times that the Help America Vote Act was going to be implemented in New York State, because the deadline, after all the extensions, came down to the first federal election in the state of New York that must be accessible. So they came up, the attorneys for the Department of Justice and the attorneys for the state Department of Elections, came up with this plan, this wonderful plan that they called Plan B, which was going to implement the Help America Vote Act by that first federal election of 2006, and all people were going to be able to vote with or without their disabilities. But to do that, they had to contact their local Board of Elections to make arrangements for transportation to a site where an accessible ballot marker was going to be located. And we were going to have to go there and use this accessible, what they called accessible, ballot marker to mark our ballots that we couldn't read back. And because it was a different site than our precinct, our ballots are going to be treated as absentee ballots. And they guarantee us that our ballots will be counted within the week, but not on election day. And when we're done with this election of 2006 and Plan B works and we get it out of our way, we're going to throw away all of these machines, and we're going to start from scratch again, trying to find an accessible machine that we can put in all precincts and make voting accessible to people with disabilities in New York. I've been pounding the pavement, explaining to everybody I meet that this is an unacceptable result, and we need to make sure that we protest this election and bring the media to our election precinct, where we should demand we cast our ballot as privately and as independently as we can for this election, and demand accessibility for people who are blind and ultimately disabled in all aspects, the accessibility that we deserve as citizens. And we need to be out there doing this, because other states, and I commend Paul in Florida for the work that they've done in making it happen down there, but New York State doesn't seem to have anything in place that's going to work for 06. And at the rate they are moving, maybe by 2010, we'll have private voting in New York State. Thank you.
I said it was moving towards the more contentious. And then I wanted to kind of close with the state that I'd heard in the past, and well, they'd had been getting it right. And then the question is, well, is that true or not? And have there been any changes? And that way it let us know, like Paul mentioned, you can't let your guard down. You have to be vigilant. And so for that, we have Pat Sheehan representing Maryland.
Madam Chair? Mm-hmm. This point of personal privilege, Jim East, the Florida Division of Blind Services. Should I be recognized, or go ahead and speak?
I have to admit, I am not on organizational parliamentary procedure. I'm hoping that we can do any questions or comments after everyone's had a chance to speak from the panel, if that's all right.
Sure, I'll wait.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. Hello?
Yes.
Is this on?
Yes.
Okay, good. Thanks. I want to give you what's going on in Maryland. We had started in 2002 being fully accessible. We have the D-Bolt machines in Maryland, And we have 20,000 machines, all Diebold, all one manufacturer throughout the state. We thought we were doing very well. As a matter of fact, let me give you some highlights of some of the positives that have happened in the state. When the Diebold machines first were installed in 2002, we had just about all the counties in Maryland using the Diebold machines. When we needed to go out and educate the individuals, particularly the disabled, on how to use the machines, the Board of Elections came to the ACB, as opposed to the NFB, who had a previous relationship with Diebold. I think the reason they did that was because they felt that we were very reasonable, that we would be fair and give impartial information regarding the voting machines. And I think this worked out very, very well. I'm very pleased with the relationship that we have with Diebold in the state of Maryland. I think it has really been a very positive step. And we were doing very, very well in 2002, 2003. The elections were getting more and more streamlined. We were not running into as many problems. And then all of a sudden we hit Johns Hopkins, Ave Rubin, and all the security problems that have come up. And we have had a lot of issues that have come up. We've had a lot of questions, and you've heard some of them this morning regarding the voter verifiable paper audit trail. And that also has arisen in the state of Maryland. What we have seen in Maryland is that we've got a very large contingent that wants to mandate that we use a voter verifiable paper audit trail within the state, and that the Diebold machine should be dumped, $55 million worth of equipment, which I consider to be very accessible, very usable, user-friendly, and which we have invested a lot of time and material and information on. The contingent with the paper audit trail has said that because these machines are not accessible, because they don't give us a paper trail, that we need to go to something different. They, in this past year, when they put forward a new RFP, basically tried to get us to switch to something like the AutoMark machine. Our legislature rejected that because we could not get the machine demonstrated within Maryland. And we do not have the capacity for dumping 20,000 machines in one election period to put forward some technology, the AutoMark machines, that we can't even get demonstrated within the state. The real problem within Maryland has to do with, and Paul really touched on it, has to do with the security of the machines. And we get computer science scientists, and we get advocates, and everyone is giving both sides to every story. The area of machine security, of voter, of being able to audit what the vote has been, is a little bit different in the state of Maryland. Maryland does things a little bit differently. One of the things that I learned is that before the election, the Board of Election runs a what you would call a parallel election. They will run an election through these machines, of which they know the totals of who they're going to vote for and what the numbers should look like. So they're going to test the Diebold machines before each election to make sure that each Diebold machine is working properly. This is done before the election, so they have a great deal of certainty with respect to these machines. They also are able to take the totals from inside the machine, compare them with the totals that they should have for the people that have come to the precincts, so there's another way that we can check these machines within the state to make sure that they're totaling properly. And lastly, and this has been talked about a little bit, there is a way to generate a paper from the machine because the results are stored in the machines in two or three different locations. In 2004, there was a contention within one of the counties within the state of Maryland, and they ran the Diebold machines against people who were using paper within that county to vote. And what they found was that the Diebold machines were much more accurate than the paper, that there was a much higher rate of accuracy. You didn't have the overvoting, the undervoting. So they are very, very happy with those results. So we have a lot of mixed results coming from Maryland. The paper audit people will come in and they will cite examples of problems with the machines. But then they don't talk about the problems that we might have with paper and how paper can be inaccurate and how you can undervote and overvote and what are they going to do about that. Lastly, when you talk about an audit, and I think this is what it comes down to, if you are going to insist on using a paper as an audit trail with these machines, you are basically taking innovation and you're stifling it. The manufacturers would like to work on a different type of security, making sure that not just Diebold, but all the manufacturers use an audit system that they can be, they can feel is secure, they can feel is safe, they feel that it will generate confidence. And if we rely on just paper, this type of innovation within not only the Diebold machines but all the other machines is going to stop. We're mandating one piece of one type of verification, only paper. And to go back state by state and have to change that later on is going to be difficult. So one of the things that Maryland is advocating for, of course, is security, is auditing, but they want to try to look at some new techniques for doing this and not be tied to just the paper. Thank you very much.
All right. So hopefully everyone got an opportunity to hear about what's going on in some of the different states, from, you know, where things are going well relatively to things not going so well to how quickly things can change. And we actually seem to be running ahead of time, so I actually think if there are any questions for the panel, you know, by all means.
Good morning. Where does it go? Okay. I'm Marcy Scott from Vero Beach, Florida, and my question possibly is not for this exact panel, but just before convention, I was called on the phone and asked, could I be a speaker at classes for poll workers about helping blind voters? And I first thought, duh, what do I know? And then I thought, maybe there'd be some sort of standard training brochure or piece of paper that ACB might have written, or a person whom I could ask here at the convention for some ideas or a basic standard of what information any of us who is asked to help poll workers, help the visually impaired, so that I wouldn't just be going in there and saying, oh, be friendly and make sure you don't vote for your candidate and that's it, but give some real positive and useful information. So I'm sort of three steps back from this panel, but I'm wondering if anyone could contact me in some way or maybe give an answer here. Thank you very much.
I could answer that question. In California, there's actually been written a poll workers manual for people with disabilities, and it's actually an excellent thing. Our committee was able to put into it a lot of information that would be of help to any poll workers. And I could probably get a copy of that document and send it to you if I could get anyone's information that would be interested in seeing that document.
This is Jim East with the Florida Division of Blind Services. Just wanted to let everybody know that's from Florida that after Motor Voter was passed, the Vocational Rehabilitation and Blind Services district offices can register clients to vote. And I feel that's an honor myself, and it's a privilege every time I get to register another blind client or visually impaired client. So I want to let any of you know, for the record, if you're not sure where your district office is, the state office is 1-800-342-1828, and they can give you the number for your district office. So register to vote. It's really, really important. I also wanted to ask one question. The accessible voting in your various states. A lot of us states, I noticed in California when I was out there, as well as in Florida, we have early voting. Are those ballots, accessible machines, going to be available throughout the whole voting process? And I appreciate your time.
It varies from county to county in Florida. And usually they certainly won't be available in all precincts, just as they aren't for other voters. In my county, there are three or four locations where accessible machines are typically available 1 to 2 weeks prior to elections. The other thing that I'd add to what Jim says, just so other people know about it, all community colleges public universities' access service offices are also required to register voters.
This is Marlene.
Mr. Michael Chairman. Byington.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Wait. Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, this is why I hate being up here because it makes me nervous. Marlene, I think, got her Madam Chair in just a split second before you, Michael, so if we do that.
And Jean Barton's in the wings.
Charlie Hodge.
Doug Town.
Okay.
Okay.
Marlena. All right, Marlena, if you're going to go ahead and start, and then
we have a comment from a listener. Kyle Woodruff in Utah wanted us to let everyone know that as a 26-year-old blind person, for the first time 3 weeks ago, he was able to vote independently in his primary, and he wanted to share that.
That is great, Kyle. Michael?
Thank you. I'll ask two questions very quickly and then sit down and let the panel answer. First of all, in our state, we have been fortunate to be able so far to keep VVPATs at bay. That's the voter verified paper audit trail, and they are not required. We're fighting the battle as much as Pat is in Maryland. I would like the panel to comment on the continuing advocacy efforts, because it seems to get tougher every year, and whether it's worth continuing to fight VVPATs or to try to realize that they're going to be an ill that we're going to have to deal with, and start focusing our efforts on the accessibility thereof in states that don't have them yet. The second thing that I wanted people to comment on, and I think maybe Paul has already alluded somewhat to this, is certainly we have not been satisfied with the federal certification process for machines, and on our statewide advisory panel to our Secretary of State, one of the things that I and many of my colleagues have demanded is that we have a very involved state certification process of machines that does require public hearings and that does require blind and low vision people and other disabled people to be able to put their hands on those machines and try to make them work before they are certified for our state. I would like you to comment on the efficacy of that type of program, whether you feel it's necessary, and what some of the good components of such a program would be. Thank you.
Michael, Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act is a civil rights act, and it demands that we should be treated equally as people with disabilities. Therefore, if they're going to supply us with a voter verifiable permanent paper record, we, as people who are blind and visually impaired, should be able to verify that permanent paper record as the voter. And we should not stop advocating for full accessibility no matter what any one of the states say, and we should continue to fight and sue and make sure that that permanent paper record is voter verifiable by all of the voters, not just the sighted voters.
Ray, that wasn't the question. Mike, that wasn't quite the question. what I'm looking for is percentage of efforts or focus of efforts in terms of fighting VVPATs entirely, as opposed to ensuring the requirements that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think I might be able to speak a little bit to that, the idea of fighting VVPATs entirely. And I'm like, we could do that. However, the genie is out of the bottle. States are passing VVPAT laws. They want it. There's the media, the companies that want it have put a really good spin out there. And the problem is, yes, we can spend our energy trying to fight it flat out. But you know, if we're going to be honest about it and pragmatic, it's coming down the pike. States are fighting for it. People are believing that they need it as a security issue. And unless we start looking at ways to make it accessible, we'll get caught in the trap of them going ahead and allowing it, and then us not having it be accessible.
Madam Chair, I would make 3 points, Michael, just really fast. The first one is that I think what we have to actually do is draw some fairly clear lines in the sands where we compare the effectiveness of voting machines as they are now with the effectiveness of elections prior to their adoption in any given state. And typically, you will be magnitudes better off in terms of the degree of accuracy which voting machines are producing. While the VVPAT people can point to issues, the second point I would make is those issues tend to be isolated and precinct-specific rather than speaking to problems with the machines. And third, and it really answers your second question, if you have a really tough state process that can build in 2 or 3 fail-safes in each machine, the chances of having verifiable error in a precinct diminish to an infinitesimal proportion and essentially give VVPAT people very little, few legs to stand on.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair. Let's go down the list of who is already in line to speak and then start Gene adding Barton, again.
Charlie Hodge.
Doug Town.
Gene Barton.
Okay, I think it was Gene Barton, Doug Town, and then Charlie Hodge, if I remember correctly.
No, it wasn't.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was Charlie
Hodge.
This is Gene Barton from Pennsylvania. And we are involved with the voter coalition in our state. We have been for the disabled. One of the questions I'd like to ask the panel, how are you working with other disabilities in terms of machine accessibility for all disabilities? Because that really is an issue with us. We find that they're accessible for us as blind people, but they are not for others. And then you've got to go back and really work twice as hard to cover all bases, and I don't think we need to be in a battle over accessibility for one disability over another. So if the committee could comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
If I could comment. This is Pat Sheehan. We are lucky in Washington that everybody seems to get involved in everything, particularly voting. So we have had AAPD get involved with voting as it applies in Maryland, and Jim Dixon has been fairly vocal. I don't know sometimes how accurate, but he's been very vocal with respect to voting issues and particularly with the VVPAT. One of the things that he demonstrated, and this was sort of a surprise to me, is that when you're talking about paper verification, it's not that simple. Are you going to use a and duplicate the ballot specifically? Is it going to look identical like the paper ballot? Is it going to be one-sided or two-sided? How is the paper going to be supplied, and what is the size of the paper and the weight of the paper and the cost? And how are you going to do that? So it is difficult. I will say in response to what Day said, 70% of the states now have a requirement for a voter verifiable paper audit trail. So I think that is something that's out there, and I don't think you can put that genie back in the bottle. However, I think also that you can require that VVPAT is accessible, and you're not going to accept any equipment until it is. Back to one thing that Michael said, I think that we've also found that we are working with the groups that want to make the paper audit trail, we're not quite sure which way it's going to go in Maryland. But we do know that whatever that paper audit trail is, if we get it in Maryland, we certainly need to make it accessible. So we're trying to coordinate our efforts in a couple of different regions. I definitely don't want to see the Diebold machines, and I don't think Marylanders do either, to be taken away and put something else put in place that we've never laid our hands on.
And just as a note, last year a resolution was passed at convention stating that ACB supports machines that are accessible, and that if there is a VVPath that is accessible. However, it wasn't the statement within that resolution wasn't just to people who are blind and visually impaired. It actually said is accessible to people with all disabilities. And so I think it reflected very much ACB's spirit of collaboration on the issue.
Right. I would really recommend that people take a look at the AAPD website, because there is a lot of good information about trying to balance the needs of a broad range of people with disabilities. And I'd make two sentence quick point. One, remember that voting accessibility for other people with disabilities often involves access to precincts, and we really do need to work with other disability groups to make sure that happens for them. And second, we are never going to make the voting process accessible to every single person with a disability until we come up with an entirely different method of voting some 40 or 50 years down the road. The reality is we must do some sort of a balancing act where the vast majority of people with disabilities are served effectively and appropriately by whatever method we arrive at. And I think all of us in virtually all states where things are going well are involved in coalitions with a broad range of disabled people to make sure that happens.
Mr. Chairman.
Madam Chair.
I'd just like to add one final thing. Working with the cross-disability groups is one way of ensuring access, but you might want to also reach out to the non-English-speaking groups in your state, because the Voters Rights Act implies that in precincts where another language is spoken more fluently than English, that the ballot be made available to them in that language. And it's come up recently in the press because this Congress is trying to do away with the Voters Rights Act and not reauthorize it. So you may want to work with those groups because their issues are very similar to our issues.
Madam Chair,
yes, Charlie.
Doug Town with Disability Relations Group. I appreciate the chair's indulgence.
I think Charlie just was on that, and then so Charlie and then Doug.
Okay.
So,
hello, this is Charlie Hodge. Pat Sheehan made a reference in his initial presentation about undervoting and overvoting. I want to just tell people that in a lot of states, including Ohio and other states, if you have a ballot with 12 different offices, some federal, some state, on the ballot, and you, let's say, for a county a sewer authority, and it says vote for 2, and you happen to mark 3 candidates, that only one office where you have an overvote, most of these machines, even though for 11 offices, there's no doubt as to how what you wanted to your intention of voting, the machines will kick out your entire ballot, even for those 11 offices where your choice was clear. They say it's because they don't have the manpower, the actual human beings, to look at the ballot and thereby count your vote for the offices where your intention is clear. Your entire ballot is thrown out. And I just want Pat to comment about overvoting and undervoting, at least in Maryland.
Thank you, Charlie. I'll be happy to. Our experience in Maryland has been that overvoting or undervoting, well, overvoting in particular, in Maryland, if you do happen to overvote, it will notify you that is not possible and will not accept it. So there has been an attempt by the software in these machines to not allow you to overvote. And that, I think, is one of the one of the positives with the D-Bolt machines. It also allows you to go back, as I think everyone here knows, and to verify verify what your choices are before you go and submit your final ballot. So, Charlie, I know in Virginia you have different types of equipment. Our experience in Maryland is, of course, you can undervote. You don't have to vote for three. You can just vote for one. But it will not allow you to overvote, and I think that's a positive with these machines.
The last thing that I would add to that is it's really crucial to include overvoting and undervoting as core components of your state certification process for machines.
Yes. And that's true in California, too. It is included in the certification process that it has to be able to tell you if you're undervoting and overvoting so that you can correct it.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Doug Town with Disability Relations Group. I want to thank your indulgence for allowing me to speak. First of all, I wanted to thank the FCB. I've been a little bit involved in Florida's efforts and some efforts across the country. The FCB, Paul, and I have talked many times, and he has been, and the FCB has been extremely supportive of the efforts here in Florida from the very beginning. Also, across the country, I have to say that ACB affiliates and members show up every place we go. They give us great input. They are sometimes necessarily in the face of local election officials, making it clear what has to be done. And I personally want to thank the ACB and FCB. And I've worked with artists in California as well. And y'all have done tremendous work. And I wanted to ask the panel to comment, and it is my hope that you will continue to support efforts, because the Congress still owes the supporters of HAVA about $890 million in authorization in order to complete access to polling places and so on. And we're hoping to see that in the next budget. So we would welcome your support to make that happen as well.
I think there are three outstanding components of HAVA that we really need to continue to push for. One of them is obviously to encourage Congress to provide as much funding to individual states who continue to qualify for funding. The second is to ensure that the commission that is part of HAVA gets appointed to include a substantial enough number of individuals with disabilities that our issues will be heard. And the third is to be absolutely certain that the federal standards that begin to emerge that relate to both machines and voting registration rights get written in ways that are appropriate and effective. And there's a lot of pressure that's being apparently felt at the federal level to water down all three of these components, and we do need to be vigilant with regard to all three of these things.
All right. I actually hate to cut off discussion if it's at all possible. I guess the lady who spoke earlier, I apologize, I'm terrible with voice recognition. I guess she would be the last question or comment, and then I'm afraid we're going to have to close down the panel and thank them for their time. So,
thank you. This is Patricia Kepler from Oregon, and we have a slightly different voting system. We're a vote-by-mail state, which isn't at all accessible. But we have 10 counties trying out a vote-by-phone system this year, 10 of our rural counties. And I haven't heard any direct response from how our primaries went, but I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on what your opinions are of the vote-by-phone systems and its pros and cons.
We did a study in California on vote-by-phone in Los Angeles County, and most of the people that participated in it thought it was a great system, but it was not recognized by our Secretary of State, who, by the way, now is Bruce McPherson, who's generally done an admirable job with accessibility. But as soon as he heard about the phone, he said no immediately. And most of us, because we have such a large lobby by the security folks, and there's no way that they're going to allow a vote by phone.
All right, we're going to have to end there. I want to go into recess for 15 minutes. I know we all need a break, but first I'd like to thank the panel and Dayal Mohammed for her work. And I just want to let everybody know that when we come back from break, we'll do a couple of door prizes, and we have one $50 door prize from the state of Alaska. So I need you to get out and get your break and get back quickly for that door prize.
Here this morning. Let's see, is this working? I think so.
And I'm sorry about that.
And
we are. The issue that I did
are we on here?
I
think so. I hope so.
The whole issue of the Constitution.
This is live radio at its finest.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't hear myself. I have the house, but not myself. Oh, there I am. There I am. Okay. 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 Everything's fine. All right. So this morning, thus far, we have passed an amendment that would preclude any disqualifying of members, potential members who may be members of other organizations of the blind, which is what we pretty much do anyway. But now it's been amended to the and added to the Constitution. I'm hoping that we will get Paul Edwards over here to join us. I've asked Gary, the board guy, to try to seek him out. He made a comment that I was quite interested in pursuing with him. Paul, are you here yet? I guess not. All right. And the comment dealt with what we would need to do to ensure that there would be access to voting by people with all disabilities. And I kind of wanted to pursue that with him and see where he was going in his thought process with that. We're on a break now, and the next session will be, if I recall the program correctly, the session with the National Library Service for the blind and physically handicapped. Let me just double check that. Yes, indeed. News from NLS, and I think Paul is on his way. All right. We're gonna have a chair, Mr. Paul. We are we're live and waiting for you. We are live.
Hello, Chrissy.
All right. We'll be right back with Paul Edwards in just one moment.
Freedom Scientific, a leader in Braille, screen reader, and low vision technology, is proud to participate in the 2006 ACB convention. For details on products and services, visit freedomscientific.com or call 800-444-4443. Freedom Scientific, everything in sight. Merging 30 years of refreshable Braille know-how with 21st century access, Optilec is your source for wireless Braille access to the mainstream devices that you need while increasing your choices to a wide range of applications right at your fingertips. Learn more about Optilec's wireless Braille assistance at the ACB convention in Jacksonville or visit Optilec.com. That's OPTELEC.com. Serotech, manufacturers of Freedom Box products and system access, is proud to be a partner at the 2006 ACB National Convention. More information on Serotech products and services is available at www.freedombox.info or by calling toll-free 866-202-0520 in the U.S. Serotech, providing you accessibility anywhere.
All right, we are back live and in our break, and just to my right is Paul Edwards. Welcome to ACB Radio Live.
Thank you, and I appreciate being asked to be a part of ACB Radio Live.
Well, you're always welcome at this table, my dear. I'd like you to talk a little bit about the comment you made, and please forgive me if I don't
quote it correctly, but you said something in the last panel that we aren't going to be able to make voting accessible to everyone unless we make some changes. And I wonder what your thought is about that.
Well, let's talk about the present state of the game. There are a number of disabilities that are extremely difficult to create accessible voting for. And even different states have taken different approaches towards how many of those components need to be covered. One of the most obvious instances are people who are deafblind. In order to create accessible voting for those folks, you're going to have some kind of a machine with a braille display, which doubles or triples the cost of any voting machine that you're going to adopt and adds another whole layer of complexity in terms of being certain that the components are accurate. And even more than that, it lessens the number of people who can test those systems to establish whether or not they're functioning appropriately or effectively. So you leave an immense amount of room for error. And so virtually every state and even the federal government has said, as things stand right now, trying to test or trying to create systems that are fully accessible to people who are deafblind just isn't a part of the reality. And I think what I meant by unless we make some changes is if we end up going to some kind of a telephone ballot where the braille display becomes an end product and not a part of the voting system at all, where the telephone is the voting system, then you in fact end up probably getting to a larger proportion of people with disabilities in terms of creating accessibility, because what you're actually doing is you're allowing the individual adaptations that people have already made to a telephonic system, which are pretty widely accessible to a broad range of people with disabilities, be the accessibility components for voting as well. So down the road, when we go to a telephone system or when we go to a computerized system, some kind of a secured computer-based system for voting, and I'm sure we'll get there eventually, then I think accessibility to the broad range of people with disabilities will actually happen.
Well, then, should we be advocating now for telephone systems?
No, because I think it would really confuse folks, and it would also give a lot of ammunition to the paper ballot people. I think what we have to do is praise accessible machines to the skies for the moment, and essentially say that they're the closest thing to nirvana that we know about, on the grounds that if we don't, what folks are going to say is even people with disabilities aren't happy with the current system, so let's scrap it. If we don't have something that's good for them, then it doesn't really matter, so let's go back to something that's good for us and the hell with them.
Well, how do we as advocates then reconcile within ourselves that, yes, we are advocating for accessible voting for almost everyone?
It's a really hard philosophical issue to deal with, but it's one that operates really across the board. At a community college, for example, ought we to be accessible to a student who is so impaired that student requires a sterile room in order to function? If any access to germs would cause that individual to become ill, is the college required to make its programs accessible to that student? My answer would be no. And I think that the same kind of answer applies to voting. I think that the law currently speaks to making substantial efforts to make things accessible to people with disabilities. But I think we've got to be very careful that we don't create a situation where we put ourselves in a place where by trying to get accessibility for absolutely everyone, we make demands that simply can't be met by reasonable budgets. Should every bus
be able to accommodate an iron lung. They're hard questions, but the core issue, I think, is we have to be damn sure that we don't give away too much, but we also have to be damn sure that we don't demand so much that we create a backlash that makes it all go away. And it really is a balancing act.
Yeah, a very delicate balancing act, indeed.
You know, we've got to, for instance, allow for things like sip and puff approaches to voting. If we don't do that, then we're letting a bunch of people down. We've got to make damn sure that precincts are accessible. We've got to make certain that that surfaces are accessible, that machines are portable enough that they can actually be carried out to vans if that's the way that folks want to use them. All of these things encourage a broad range of people who are physically disabled to vote accessibly. I also think it's important to say that what we're talking about here is accessible, private, and independent voting. But the fact is that all of these populations, including people who are deaf-blind, have the capacity to vote by absentee ballot, have the capacity to use early voting, have the capacity to often use some alternative methods that operate throughout the country, so that we are not actually suggesting that anyone should necessarily be disenfranchised.
All right. Well, thank you so much for stopping over here and sharing this information with us.
More than she ever wanted to hear.
More than I ever wanted to hear. What's coming up on Tuesday topics in the near future before I let you go?
Well, we're hoping next week to have Jim Gibbons, the president and CEO of National Industries for the Blind, on. I would like to also see us begin to work to get some other of the organizations out there who are working on blindness issues to hear from us, people like AER and
lovely,
so on.
Lovely. Thank you, Paul.
You're welcome.
Have a great convention.
You're listening to live coverage of the 45th Annual ACB Convention from Jacksonville, Florida. Now, here are your hosts, Chrissy Cochran and Marlena Lieberg.
And we are back. We are
pull. If nobody hollers, pull again.
We are coming into session.
Okay.
Trying to figure out what we're doing here.
Here comes door prizes. So pay attention.
Have you ever won a door?
No, but I've
okay. First one. Earlier we called for what was Dan's name? Dan Sybil. He never did answer. So we still have the prize.
Oh.
So unless somebody calls real quick, I'm going to pull another card.
Pull it.
Pull it. Okay, pull it.
10 seconds, go.
Okay, Terry Camardell from Terrytown, Louisiana.
She's gone. Next.
Nope.
Donald Kors, Indianapolis, Indiana.
She's
all
here.
All right. Congratulations.
He's here.
Okay. Jay's bringing it over. Okay. While Jay is doing that, let me pull the next one.
This is a $50 prize?
This is $50 from the great state of Alaska.
Harmon, Oceanside, California.
Roy Harmon, Oceanside, California.
Not here.
Not here. Pull again.
$50.
Colville, Washington.
Debbie Phillips, Colville, Washington.
Sounds like she's here.
All right, Debbie. You want to give it to her?
All right, Doug.
Good.
I was just handed a door prize up here. I have a talking atomic watch handed to me by MaxiAids from my home state. They're in the exhibit hall. If you could visit them, I'm sure they'd appreciate it. But I do have the talking atomic watch right here, talking atomic clock right here. So if you can pull me one for that, I'd like to give
here
it to
go.
Somebody.
Linda Strunk, Yorktown, Indiana.
Linda Strunk, Yorktown, Indiana.
No, gone.
Gone. Okay, next one.
Lori Zertouche, San Antonio, Texas.
Lori Chatouche, San Antonio, Texas.
Nope.
Well, all right. She is here? If you're here, stand
up. Is she here?
Good.
Okay, then come on up and get it. It's up here at the podium. Thank you very much, Don.
Thank you, sir.
I would like to recognize Carla for some announcements. Carla?
Thank you, Mike. As many of you know, this year we had a change in our convention sponsor program that we offer on the pre-registration form. In past years, you were able to be a gold or silver sponsor. The silver sponsors were a $25 donation. Gold sponsors were a $50 donation. This year, we changed that program and gave you a couple of other opportunities. We have a bronze sponsorship at $25, silver at $50, gold at $100, and platinum at $500. I'm going to ask Brenda Dillon to read the platinum sponsors today for you, and also the silver sponsors, and they were in today's newspaper. Brenda?
People for their generous platinum sponsorship.
Yes.
Fred Scheigert, Gerald Spinner, Nancy Spinner, Marjorie Beeman, Michael Henderson, Joel Marler, and Patricia Johnson. $500 each. Thank you, guys. And now for our list of silver sponsors contributing a very much appreciated $50 apiece. They are Thomas Lutz, Betty Jarrett, Charlie Hodge, Richard Ruida, Raymond Bud Keith, Joyce Rogers, Hilda Oliver, Ronald Moore, Chris Gray, Luann Williams, Charles Edwards, Peter Hannigan, Kenneth Rowe, Catherine Craven, John Hannigan, Liz Amateur, Gilbertine Smith, Robert Jones, Jeff Tom, Brian Charlson, Kathy Lamb, Carol McCarl, John Horst, Donna Seliger, Adam Rushable, Janice Kent, Gordon Kent, Richard Erler, Carol Ewing, and Pam Shaw. Isn't this wonderful?
Thank you, Brenda. I want to let you know that last year we collected just over $11,000 in this program, and this year we have exceeded that at this time. I also want to let you know that if your name was not on that list and you have made a and you have become a sponsor at the registration desk here, the explanation is probably that it simply has not quite gotten into the computer yet. They do the data entry at night, and so if you, for example, make buy a ticket in the morning or become a sponsor in the morning, it does not appear in the system until the evening. If there is an error, however, please let us know, and we would want to change that. We want to make sure everyone is recognized. Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd like to run over a couple of announcements very quickly.
Quickly.
I want to review the caucuses again. I've been asked a couple of times to please review that. Midwest Caucus today in Orlando. Pennsylvania Council of the Blind Breakfast Caucus in City 6 tomorrow morning. Washington Council of the Blind in City 5 for a breakfast caucus tomorrow morning. And both of those breakfasts are at 7 a.m. Also tomorrow are the following caucuses. Florida, 12:30 in Orlando. New England, 12:30 in City 12. GDUI, River City 2 at 2:45. Western States, 4:30 p.m. in City Terrace 9. Missouri, 5 p.m. in City 4. And the Mid-South Caucus in Orlando, the Mid-South Caucus in Orlando, yes. The Constitution and Bylaws Committee will not meet this evening. Ray Campbell tells me they have completed their work and there will not be another meeting. Also, the focus groups, Optelec, 1:30 and 3:30 today in City 6, and Freedom Box 230 and 4 and City 4. Remember the Red Hat Lunch and Change Women's Concerns at 1230 in River Terrace 1. One question that came to me on that is, what about the program session that follows the luncheon? It also will remain in that room, River Terrace 1. And finally, the Masons meeting at 2 p.m. in St. John's. Mr. Chairman, I think that concludes all of my announcements for this time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carla.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Who calls for the floor?
Gene Barton from Pennsylvania.
Yes, sir.
May I present a check to the ACB for $1,000 from Pennsylvania?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to continue with the morning program.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Real quickly.
Brief.
This is Karen Campbell from Illinois. If you would be careful with the mic, some of you are coming through on the ALDs, some are not. For example, Brenda Dillon, and this, when we were reading the sponsors, Brenda did not come through. Mike, you're coming through. Carla, you're coming through. It's happened on occasion. Just try to be careful, please.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Can you take that up with Jay?
Thank you, Jay. Okay, continuing with the morning program.
Excuse me, Mr. President, or Mr. Chairman, or whatever. The great state of Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Hello.
We have a check here to donate, and it's for $1,000. And we're
wonderful.
Very pleased to be able to do this.
Thank you very much.
So I don't know, where do I do it?
Okay. Are we ready? we have Frank Kurt Silke here with us today, the director of the National Library Service in Washington, D.C., who's going to talk to us about an overview, a digital overview with NLS services. And to join him is one of his colleagues, Alice Baker, which he will introduce. So can we give a round of applause for Frank Kurt Silke?
Good morning, and thank you for the applause. I'm sorry I don't have a check with me, or I would have made a donation myself. It's just that there's nothing in the account, so that it wouldn't have counted anyway. I'm very pleased to be here again, as I have been for the past three decades or so, and also to have with me NLS staff members. I think most of you know Judy Dixon, who is our consumer relations officer. Freddie Pico, who is our government information and volunteer specialist. Freddie, I think, has been with you for many years, and you can see her in the exhibit. And I also have two colleagues, Alice Baker, who in a moment will make a few remarks, and Michael Martis. This afternoon we'll be available at the Lua Group at 1:45, and you can talk to Alice, Freddie, Judy, Michael, and me, if you'd like, at that time. In past years, early years, I would make a presentation myself every year. And about 5 years ago, we made a determination that it would be very useful, rather than hearing me, to hear experts or people from NLS who have a substantive responsibility in their area of concern. And we brought Michael Moody, who is then the director of the digital program, John Bryant, who is the person responsible for producing our audio and braille books and magazines, John Hansen, the year before last, who was our music librarian, and last year we had Michael Katzman, who was our chief engineer. So this year you will have Alice Baker. But before she takes the podium, I'll just have a few general comments. One, on the digital program, we are on target. We have a target of 2008 to have the machines out, starting to come out, and the books ready. We should have 20,000 titles ready at that time, and we will be producing, signing a contract in 2007 for 60,000 audio machines, and in following years, 2008, 9, 10, and 11, they'll be in the hundreds of thousands of units. So we should end up with about approximately 600,000 units by 2011. In terms of communication, many of you would not know this, but the name Adam Rushville, when I heard it, found this. Adam was our one of our favorite librarians. But I made a trip around the United States to about 40 states. And what we came up with was talking to the librarians and to the state librarians. And what we came up with was the fact that we really weren't communicating. We thought we were. We were writing. We were speaking. But we didn't hit everyone. So we conceived the idea of having the Flash, the FLASH, which we distribute to you in our talking book topics, in our Braille book review, in our mailings to the various organizations and to the libraries and the state librarians. And I think this has helped a great deal because the number of questions regarding the digital program have dropped considerably, which means, I hope it means, that we are, you know, more on target with keeping you up to date. Alice will give you the details in just a second. We are in the process of converting titles to audio digital titles as we go on, as well as producing new ones. So for the last 4 years, every analog book that you received, in other words, every cassette book that you received, has a digital master. And those will be available in digital form in 2008. In addition to that, we've been producing approximately 1,200 books a year, converting them from analog to digital. And we've been picking those books based on the titles, Charles Dickens' works, Ernest Hemingway, and so forth, as well as the narrators that have interested you, such as Alexander Scourby. Just a comment about Web Braille. We had an awkward situation this year, as you know. We have about 4,500 users. We have approximately 8,000 titles, which include music titles as well as titles from 9 regional libraries. Iowa and Minnesota were added this year. So you have access to all the Braille books that we have available in hard copy as well as in digital. As I say, there was an awkward situation where for 8 days, 8 calendar days, I think it was 6 working days, the Web Braille was down, but it came back up and has been working, I can't say with 100% success, but with like 99.5% success. Michael Martys can talk about that this afternoon at Lua if you'd like. As you know, we continue to look for consumer input. We have panels on the digital area. We have it in the selection of materials. We have it in the machine area, and, of course, coming here. So we've appreciated your contributions, and I'll now introduce Alice Baker, who is a lawyer, a librarian, and the guardian of our digital contracts. She'll talk to you, and again, after that, we'll be available for questions, and then again this afternoon. Thank you.
Good morning. This past year has been very exciting for the National Library Service. And while I'd like to attribute that excitement to the fact that I started working here last September, I'm afraid it probably has more to do with the recent developments in the Digital Talking Book, or DTB, project. The past year has been one of great accomplishments for the DTB project. We've made many important decisions that have all come together to create the design of the new digital player and cartridge system. Of course, there remains much ground to cover. Like the title of this presentation suggests, we've broken the field and a touchdown is in sight. We are in an enviable position that we have worked hard for, but we need to keep working together to reach our goal, hold on to the ball, and keep our eyes fixed firmly on the goalposts, which are now finally in sight. Today I'm going to talk briefly about what we have accomplished since the last ACB convention and what we're looking forward to in the near future. But first, a little background. In 2004, NLS put out a request for proposal for the design and development of a talking book player and flash memory cartridge, as well as mailing containers for each. This request was developed based on functional requirements distilled from years of careful research. In February 2005, after prudent consideration and evaluation, NLS partnered with the Battelle Memorial Institute, headquartered in Columbus, Ohio, to design and develop the digital talking book. Battelle's proposal included subcontracts with VisuAid, now HumanWare Technologies, and the Trace Research and Development Center of the University of Wisconsin, among others. NLS is very pleased to be working with such world-renowned organizations that bring decades of highly technical experience in product development. Everyone working on the digital transition plan is excited about the design developments that the Battelle team has created. The player is significantly lighter than the C1. It has a more sleek, modern appearance and will be easily portable for most patrons. The book cartridge has been carefully designed to be easy to handle and use with the player. The cartridge container has been redesigned to accommodate the new shape of the cartridge and the requirements from the postal system. And the shipping container for the player will be fully recyclable. But aside from all the new design developments, the real difference is how readers are able to use the book. The DTB allows a reading experience that more closely recreates reading a physical book. Complex navigation through a book is possible, allowing readers to purposefully jump around in the text and explore information in a way not previously possible with a cassette machine. After being awarded the DTB contract, Battelle jumped into the process with both feet. In an effort to better understand NLS patrons and their needs, as well as place NLS's design and development requirements in context and expand them as needed, the team undertook a broad-reaching user needs evaluation in April and May of 2005. The sessions occurred in regional libraries around the country and through individual site visits for some elderly and physically disabled persons. In addition to looking at patrons' usage of the C1 player in detail, Battelle also gathered patron feedback on some early player models to assess preferences for various button shapes, sizes, and layouts. They also collected detailed feedback from library staff and volunteers regarding their needs and frequent issues in the total library services experiences. In further efforts to capture and analyze user needs, three rounds of extensive usability studies with NLS patrons were conducted. The studies tested and got feedback from patrons on everything from the location and function of buttons on the player, to the Braille and large print user guides, to the navigability of digital talking books, to the size and shape of the player. The result of these months of discussions, research, and analysis is two versions of the digital talking book player, one that offers a less complex utilization of the many features and functionalities offered by the digital technologies, and one that offers a greater level of complexity, including the option to set bookmarks, jump by page, jump by chapter, and more. The shape of each player is the same. And each player has the same battery power and cord storage, and both players will be able to use any cartridge in the collection. Each player offers accelerated fast-forward and rewind functions, a sleep timer option that automatically turns off the player after 15 minutes, and verbal announcements of both actions and locations in the book. Throughout the life of the project, NLS has and will continue to work closely with Battelle and other partners to achieve milestones set on an aggressive schedule designed to make the digital talking book player available to patrons in 2008. A number of charts and tracking programs are being utilized, which help to keep our efforts coordinated and on schedule. In addition to on-paper planning, the team holds weekly technical conference calls, bi-weekly general discussion conference calls, and quarterly face-to-face meetings to discuss any developments or concerns. These tools all help us work with Battelle to track both their progress and our participation, keeping communication lines open and encouraging a big-picture understanding of the issues related to developing the best digital talking book system possible. We are now moving into a very important and exciting part of the project. 3 weeks ago, NLS hosted the team in Washington, D.C. for the preliminary design review, a comprehensive review of every design aspect of the project, from software to cartridge containers to packing material. This review was a necessary step to evaluate and approve the design before moving into the creation, testing, and analysis of functional prototypes. NLS was indeed satisfied with the design and gave Battelle approval to go forward creating functional prototypes. Functional prototypes are realistic working models of the actual player that are able to be tested and retested to verify the design. The Digital Talking Book project is now in its sixth quarter of effort. During this time, the industrial and mechanical engineers are working on completing the design drawing and building functional prototypes for the player, cartridge, mailing container, and player shipping container. The electrical engineers are completing testing of the printed circuit board version 1.2 and designing and building the printed circuit board version 1.2A, as well as performing USB connector life tests. Audio engineers are testing speaker candidates for functional prototypes, and software applications continue to be tested and refined. We have elected to build 50 player prototypes, 100 cartridge prototypes, and 150 cartridge container prototypes. The functional prototype phase occurs in multiple iterative rounds and is designed to test the player's engineering and cartridge and mailing containers in various simulated real-world situations. Some of the player prototypes will be destroyed as we push the limits through testing, and some will be used, hopefully more gently, usability testing in the homes of players. This testing continues through the summer and fall, concluding in November at Critical Design Review. The result of Critical Design Review is a final physical design. It's then on to the pre-production models, which are further refined versions of the player, using what we've learned from the functional prototype testing. Once these are built, they will be tested for verification and specifications and validated against user requirements through more usability testing. Along the way, we will be working on writing the request for proposals necessary to find a manufacturer for both the cartridge and the player. Different vendors will manufacture the player and the cartridge, and separate contracts will be written to support the production. The proposals will be in two phases, the first so that we may pre-qualify potential manufacturers, and the second to actually contract to produce the player and cartridges. These two development prongs, designing the player and writing the contract, will come together in May of 2007 with the delivery of the final technical data package from Battelle to NLS, which will be transferred to our contractor to manufacture the players on a large scale. The transition plan requires careful planning, and NLS has initiated meetings with the Library of Congress's Contracting Office and the Office of General Counsel to begin the formal acquisition planning process. Again, our target date for transferring the design to manufacture is May 2007, and 2008 has been targeted to begin distributing DTB players to patrons. There are many elements of the digital project assigned for designing the player, cartridge, and mailing containers. Every morning, a core group of digital team members meets to discuss any pressing issues or upcoming events related to the project. As can be imagined, it's necessary to constantly monitor all elements of the project, and this meeting assures everyone is on the same page first thing in the morning. Every Tuesday and Thursday, an expanded team meets for an hour to discuss and make decisions critical to the project. By discussing and deciding as a group, we are able to take into consideration all the areas of NLS that may be impacted by a decision. NLS has identified 39 unique tasks to be accomplished internally for the Digital Talking Book project, excluding design and development of the player. Each responsible party provides a weekly update related to their tasks, which encourages communication with management and other team members. These reports provide a forum to bring potential problems to light and ensure that the right people address any issues quickly and directly. An interesting task or project that's been developed as part of the digital transition project is the digital download pilot. NLS is currently working on making a subset of its collection available to be downloaded from a computer onto flash memory cartridge and then played on a specially modified version of HumanWare's Victor Reader Classic Plus with recording playback machine. 100 patrons have been selected based on certain criteria to participate in the pilot. These patrons will be provided the modified player with many similar features as the NLS player and will actively participate by downloading and evaluating digital talking books and magazines and providing us with valuable feedback about their experience. We are especially excited about this pilot project because it offers NLS the opportunity to thoroughly test the DTBs, ensuring that our patrons continue to receive the high-quality material that has been provided by NLS for over 75 years. Working with the Patel team to design, develop, and manufacture the digital talking book system has been a rewarding experience. I hope NLS patrons will have an equally, if not more, rewarding reading experience using the new digital talking book machine in 2008. Thank you.
Are there any questions you might like to ask at this time, or we would be, as I say, we'd be delighted to be here at the LUA meeting this afternoon? I'm Kurt Silke. I'm not the chairman, but...
Yes, I have a question.
The mic is behind you. There you go.
Yes, Mr. Silke, I have a question. Carla Rushable from Kentucky.
Yes.
I'm just curious, on the WebRail issue, I have a question concerning the WebRail site. I understand that there were, quote, security issues which interrupted the WebRail service. And I'm very glad that it has returned. I have to tell you that I homeschool my grandson, and I use those books daily to read to him, and we very much enjoy them. However, I am concerned that when the site came back up, that in order to download each volume, we have to go through a process of this, I agree to all of these, you know, to these terms.
Yes.
And I find that a bit interesting because I do a lot of Internet shopping and surfing, and I use a lot of other sites. Needless to say, I'm kind of an Internet junkie. And my problem is that sites that involve all kinds of things that are sensitive and secure and require security do not require an I agree on every screen. I also have a problem with the security because when I signed up for WebRail, I don't know about anyone else, but I had to give my state librarian the password that I wanted to use on that site. And I have been able to not, I have been unable to find any way, any means of changing that password. Therefore, being able to ensure that what I do on that site is secure. And I just wonder if you could address for us how these two issues fit together. Seemingly overzealous use of the I agree on every single volume, and then on the other hand, the inability of the user to ensure our own secure access to that site. Thank you.
I think you have a very reasonable question, and I think I'm going to divide it into two pieces. I don't know whether this will be acceptable to you or not. This afternoon at the LUA meeting at 1:45, Mr. Martys and I. What? No, well, it's okay. At the meeting this afternoon at 1:45, Mr. Martys and I will be there, and so will Judy Dixon, who is responsible in the office for the WebRail site, and they will be able to address the business of the questions and so forth. Let me just generally talk to the security. What you have is a situation where publishers have made, and authors, copyright holders, have made available books to you as a blind person with the guarantee that it'll, that when we publish them, they only go to blind people. There was a security breach, and there have been some egregious use of the site. It was down for a very short time, came back up. We appreciated the overwhelming response, you know, that we got. I think it was more than 300 emails, primarily from members of ACB. Your interest was appreciated. We do understand how important it is to you, but the security has to be there. It's not in the same situation as ordering a book from Amazon.com or ordering a dress or other items of material. I really would say to you, let me give you one example, just a general example with no names attached. There was one person in the United States who was downloading 1,000 books a day. All right? I think enough said. You need a book. You just have to say, I agree to the requirements that I won't make it possible. You can do two books. If you do 1,000, it's not you, Mrs. Rushville. If you do 1,000 books, you're going to have a heck of a time at it. That's my comment for the moment.
Mr. Silkey?
Yes.
Rob Hill from Oklahoma?
Yes.
How would the priority be established for who gets the digital players?
By law, veterans of the armed forces are first priority, and that's what we're putting as a mandatory legal requirement. The Digital Long-Term Planning Group has been discussing that, and the most recent recommendation was leaving it up to each of the regional libraries to make their own criteria. As you can imagine, there's nearly three quarters of a million people on the list, and there will be only a few units, 60,000 in the first year, and then into the hundreds of thousands. But if you're a veteran, has first priority.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Silkey.
One more question, they said.
Mr. Silkey. Gene Lozano from California.
Yes.
I just wanted to confirm the first thing was that the new player will still be loaned to individuals and they will not have to incur any costs of purchasing.
That is absolutely correct.
And the second one is it going to be compatible with the digital books with RFB?
Well, it's going to be a flash memory device, and RFB&D is putting out of digital books that can be used on your desktop computer or can be a CD-based book. So until RFB&D adopts the flash format, it will not.
I work with disabled students, and this is a concern of having to use various different formats, and the question I had been asked to inquire.
Yes, no, I understand that. Just not a lengthy answer, but you realize that same situation that existed in the analog world when we went to the four-track half-speed cassette. And the world in the United States changed and adopted that format. We believe that a similar situation will occur here. We had to have a unique system. We have to have the most cost-effective system that we can have. We're talking about producing, in the near future, 700,000 machines. They will cost approximately $200 each. We perceive that other people will adopt this technology and follow in that way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman. I got it.
Thank you, Mr. Silkey. Thank you, Ms. Baker.
Steve Harrison here from Maryland.
Hang on, Steve. Please join them. Please join them today up at Lua, and you can continue to ask your questions there. Steve, is it quick?
Yes, it is. I just want to know what the criteria would be for testing these units.
Cool. Can you bring that up to the Lua group today?
If I have a chance to, I'll bring it up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Continuing with our program, we're running a little late. I'm sorry that I'm kind of cutting it short.
One more question. I'm interested in serving on the selection committee for the books that are actually chosen by the NLS. How do you go about getting on that committee?
Can you come up to Lua and you can discuss that with Mr. Silkey yourself?
Well, is it a...
He asked that you come up there at 1:30 today.
Okay, I can't come to it, but I'll just contact NLS if you can't answer the question now.
He's coming down to talk to you now.
Deborah Chandler.
Excuse me?
Deborah Chandler, North Carolina.
Yes.
I see her. I'll be there in a minute.
He's coming down now. Okay, continuing. To join us now in the program is a voice I'm sure you'll all recognize. Michael Miller from Brooklyn, New York, is going to talk to us a little bit about the Louis Braille Touch of Genius
and he's going to join us and discuss that issue with us. We have to keep in mind that 2009 will be the 200th anniversary of the birth of Louis Braille, and Mr. Miller will join us to talk to us a little bit about Louis Braille.
Well, good morning. I feel as though I'm... Can you hear me okay? Yeah, okay. I'll hold the mic. That's better. This is probably the 20th ACB convention I've been to, so I feel quite at home here. And I'm very happy to be here, too. Well, Louis Braille, to get him in context, you know, he was born a long time ago, as our chairman just mentioned, in 1809. That was the same year Abraham Lincoln was born. And it was also the year Charles Darwin was born, the great scientist, who was in fact born on the same day as Abraham Lincoln. He was born in a little town called Couvray, that's Couvray, which is about 25 miles east of Paris. In those days, that was really very rural. To get to Paris from Couvray when Braille was born was a four-hour journey in a stagecoach. Couvray itself has changed very little, but the area around has changed considerably. About 10 minutes away from Louis Braille's birthplace is Euro Disney. Louis was born in the kitchen of the house where they lived, and his mother, Monique, which is Monica, was 39, which in those days was close to middle age. They already had two girls and two boys in the family. Louis was the youngest, and his father, Simon René, was then 44. So he was probably an unexpected child, and the parents hoped that he would become their support in old age. They were a family of modest means. They weren't poor, but they weren't rich either. The father made his living as what was called in French a bourrelier, which means he made the harnesses, the leather harnesses, straps and so on, that were used to capture the power of the horse. These harnesses were not just simply a few straps thrown together. They really were works of art. And very often, the leather had intricate patterns carved into it. So Louis Braille's father was very much a perfectionist and an artist. And Louis Braille, we think, inherited some of these characteristics. He was certainly a perfectionist. The family was very self-reliant, and again, Louis Braille was. They had some income, of course, from the harness-making business, but they also had their own cow, they had some chickens, they had a vineyard from which they produced enough wine to keep them going for a year. And that was stored in a big cask in the cellar of the house. When Louis was only 3 years old, this is in 1812, he had a bad accident. Self-inflicted, I have to say, and that is what blinded him. There is a very detailed account of this accident, and I think I'm pretty clear about how it happened. He was sitting in his father's workshop, remember he was only 3 years old, trying to copy what his father did. And Louis picked up a piece of leather and also a small curved blade, a very sharp blade, almost like a pruning hook, but a miniature pruning hook. And we think he was trying to perhaps carve some kind of pattern in the leather, and he was holding the leather very close to his eye. The tool slipped and sliced his right eye open. So it bled badly. He would have been in quite severe pain. And, of course, in those days, no one knew what to do. An old woman from the village applied lily water to the wound. That just might have made it worse by infecting the wound even more. Within 2 years, his other eye became blind, too. And that is often described as just because the other eye became infected. But that probably is not what happened. This was a condition known as sympathetic ophthalmia, where the undamaged eye becomes blind too. And it's thought to be, modern science now thinks it was a case of the immune system trying to repair the damaged eye, went awry, and began to damage the healthy eye. So after about 2 years, His right eye was totally opaque, and his left eye was partially opaque, but had a few blue streaks in it from what was left of the blue part of the eye. He had blue eyes and blonde hair. Braille loved the town he was born in, and since the family was very well known, because all the farmers came to his father to get their harnesses either made or repaired, they were very fond of Louis Braille. Now, it so happens that there were two other blind people in the town. One was in his 60s, one was in his 40s. Both were destitute. Now, we don't know whether this affected the Braille family's attitude towards their little boy, but they were determined that he would receive an education. And so, shortly after he became blind, the local priest took him under his care and began to teach him in an office of the local church, St. Peter's. And also, when the summer weather was there, Louis received lessons outside. And Louis was very bright. He learned very quickly. So after about a year of being taught by the priest asked the local school teacher if he would accept Braille into the local school. So he was mainstreamed back in 1812. Again, in school, he was very bright. He often outshone the sighted kids. And in fact, the teacher recorded that sometimes he was dumbfounded by the responses, by turns pertinent and amusing, of Louis Braille. However, in the aftermath of the French Revolution, everything was changed, and they tried to introduce a new system of teaching in the local school of Couvray. Louis' parents didn't like this because they tended to be on the conservative side. They were not pro-revolutionary. They liked the old-fashioned ways of speaking, the old-fashioned ways of behaving. And they remained devout Catholics all their lives, as did Louis Braille. So when they tried to change the teaching system in the local school, the parents wanted to find some other way of getting an education. By one of those fortunate chances that actually occur very frequently in Louis Braille's life, the local teacher had heard of a school in Paris, a new school that would give an education to blind children. Furthermore, the local lord of the manor, Monsieur d'Orvilliers, had in fact helped to finance this school when it was founded in about 1786 by a man called Valentin Aouy, of whom probably you've heard. We think it was probably by these kinds of contacts that Louis Braille was admitted to the school in Paris. And he entered there in 1819. Although the school gave him an excellent education, in fact, it also killed him, because the school was extremely unhealthy. It was located right down near the River Seine. It was damp. It was cold. For kids who walked around the building touching the walls to navigate, the walls were damp and slimy. The water they used for drinking and also for bathing just came right out of the river. And the river was very contaminated because garbage was just tossed into the river. So he was a very bright student. And he also showed musical talent while at the school. And one year, he won a whole batch of prizes, which I will describe to you. I've got to find my place here. I know he won a prize for cello, for geography, for math, for writing an essay. And the prizes he won were piled upon the bench beside him where he was sitting. Now, he was about 5'9" tall, and these books and documents piled higher than little Louis Braille himself. The director of the school, let me just get a little bit more about the health of the school. There was a report from the government about the health of the students at the school, and I'm going to quote from that briefly. It said, "The first thing that struck us was the deathly white complexion of most of the students. Several showed signs of scrofula, that's tuberculosis, which is what Louis Braille got, and some even have swollen glands. Many, especially the girls, have poor digestions, a condition rare among adolescents, and whose cause we can find in the building and surrounding area. So we can't prove it, but it's pretty certain that that is where Louis Braille caught tuberculosis. So he was sick, really, from the time he entered the school. But it was not until 1835, when he was 26, that he realized what was wrong when he had a bad coughing spell and coughed up blood. There was the evidence that he had TB. The students had a 15-hour day there, which included intellectual work, music, manual skills. They had meals, there was recreation, and religious devotions. The directory, the head of the school tried to teach the children skills that would be useful where they lived. So, for instance, the students who lived in a port town would learn rope making. At one time, whips were made at the school, although that didn't prove very profitable, and that was soon stopped. They also made mats that sold very well, knitting, which was sold in shops in Paris. And Louis Braille, showing leadership skills as well as manual skills, at the age of 14, became the foreman of the slipper workshop. This is how the director described Louis Braille. Endowed with a great facility, with a lively intelligence, and above all, with a remarkable soundness of mind, Braille became well known for his progress and success in his studies. His literary or scientific compositions included nothing but precise thoughts. They were distinguished by a great clarity of ideas expressed in a clear and correct style. In 1820, Louis Braille's life changed. He was 19 then. No, he was 21 then. A man called Barbier, Charles Barbier, who was a military captain, arrived at the school with this system that he'd invented for use by the military. It consisted of, to speak in Braille terms, which was didn't exist then, this was raised dots in a 12-dot cell, two columns of six dots. And he hoped that he could sell this system to the military because it could be read by touch and written by touch, so the soldiers wouldn't have to light a lamp and thereby reveal their position. Louis Braille was given samples of this code to see what it was like, because by this time there was a new director of the school, a man named Pinier, who became very important to Louis Braille, and he, in a very open-minded way, said the only people who can tell if this system is any good are the blind children themselves. So they took samples home, and they could work with it. The code, actually, was not very good. It was not based on the alphabet, so there was no spelling, there was no punctuation, no grammar, no numbers, and it was impossible to write music with it. But Louis Braille went home, and he worked on this code, and he brought out the improvements that we know to this day. It has not changed, basically, since he completed it, his code, in 1824, when he was only 15. I actually think he did this because he was young, and no one had told him what you were not supposed to do. He didn't know what he wasn't supposed to do. In fact, it reminds me of Helen Keller saying, while they were saying it was impossible, it was done. Louis Braille didn't know any better, so he changed the whole code. Later on, Barbier, who had invented his code, praised Louis Braille very highly. He said, "I cannot praise too highly the kind of feelings which prompt you to be useful to those who share your misfortune. Much can be expected of the enlightened sentiments which guide you." Very true. When he was 19, Louis Braille was appointed a teacher at the school. He taught grammar and geography to both sighted and blind children. The sighted children came to the school for free, got a free education. In return for that, they had to help the blind people in guiding them around, helping reading to them, and also working in the printing shop. Five years later, he was promoted to full teacher, which gave him a pay increase, which, by the way, Louis Braille was very good with money. He lived carefully. He saved money. He even lent money out to other students when they were running short. Also, when he was promoted, he was enabled to wear a special uniform, which was a dark blue, and had on the lapels silk or gilt laurel wreaths, which were symbols of learning. And he liked to wear the uniform when he walked around Paris and when he was going out to play the organ. He walked around confidently, we are told that in some of the research I've done, and often used, put his hand on the shoulder of a young boy, a teenage boy, who would guide him through the streets. He was a very popular teacher. Again, let me quote you briefly. He functioned as a teacher with such charm and wisdom that for his students, the requirement to attend class was transformed into a pleasure. They competed among themselves, not only to be equal to or better than each other, but to make a sincere and continuous effort to please their teacher, whom they loved as a wise and enlightened friend, overflowing with good advice. And he did indeed help people. Again, his practicality, which I think came from his rural background in a very practical family. On one occasion, a friend of his who got a pension from one of the charities in Paris was not getting the best of it. And Louis Braille figured out how he could, by going to the various places, get a few more francs in exchange for this. It must have been some kind of money order in which the pension was paid. In 1831, Louis Braille's father died. And from his deathbed, the father, in a letter that was written by Louis Braille's brother, asked Dr. Pinier, the director of the school, never to abandon his brother, that is, not to abandon Louis Braille. And Dr. Pinier said that indeed, that request was answered even before it was asked. And from that time on, Dr. Pinier, the head of the school, was like Louis Braille's substitute father. And he was very important in introducing Braille to some of the higher echelons of Parisian society. He would take Braille out to, you know, fairly fancy parties, and Braille would play the piano so well, playing Mozart, for instance, and often the people there were moved to tears. But Louis didn't like that, because he didn't like to feel pitied. My book also has a chapter devoted to Braille music, which I have to say I knew nothing about pretty much before I started to write it, but I was able to get some good advice from people in the field. Because Louis Braille was very musically talented, played the organ in some of the leading churches in Paris. In 1829, he'd figured out the system. I'm sure some of you here use it, and it hasn't changed basically since then. 1829, he was 30 years old. And also around that time, he seemed to want to change his job as teacher. He was offered the job or applied for the job as organist in the Cathedral of Meaux, which is not too far from where he was born. In the end, he turned it down because it didn't pay enough money. That was basically it. Again, pretty practical guy. But also it would have required him to make a bit extra money by going around the area tuning pianos, and he was a trained piano tuner. But he would have had to live as a seminarian, presumably in some kind of dormitory. And since being promoted to teacher, he had his own room at the School for the Blind. One achievement, I see my time is getting a bit short, I want to be quick here. I must mention one achievement that has been largely forgotten. He was very concerned about finding some way that the blind children could communicate with sighted people. Remember, many of them came from outside Paris. They had really no means of communicating with their friends and families back home. No telephone, certainly no email. So Louis invented a system which was based on a dot, very much like the Braille dot, whereby people could write the shapes of print letters on a sheet of paper. The shapes were rather large, so you couldn't get more than a few words on a page, but it did work, and both sighted people and blind people could read it. But the big step that was made was when he talked to his friend Victor Foucault, who actually miniaturized this system and enabled a blind person, by using various pistons, to position dots in a 10x10 matrix to form the shape of letters. And the shape was about the size of ordinary print. At first, it just made holes in the paper, which both sighted people could read and the blind people could read it by touch, too. But later on, Louis Braille himself figured out it was better to use carbon paper so that a carbon copy was used, a nice black copy that was easier for sighted people to read. And some of his letters in that format still exist, and they're perfectly clear to read, and they are exactly a dot matrix printer. So he invented the dot matrix printer. In 1840, there was another disturbing event in Louis Braille's life. Because of internal politics in the School for the Blind, Dr. Pinier was fired. I don't know how many of you work in academic life. I did many years ago and didn't like it. But it is said that in academic life, the infighting is so severe because the stakes are so low. But anyway, this was true in Paris, and Dr. Pinier's deputy, a man called Armand Dufaux, plotted with the politicians to have Dr. Pinier fired. So Louis Braille lost his mentor on the scene. But Dufaux went beyond that. He actually banned the use of Braille within the school. This was in part simply a sort of vengeance against Dr. Pinier's protector, Braille's protector, Dr. Pinier, because Pinier was regarded as being too religious by Dufaux, who was a secularist and a Republican. And the evidence against Dr. Pinier was one of the first documents to be published in Braille was the Lord's Prayer in several languages. Dr. Pinier also encouraged the students to play the organ. It was a good career, but that meant going to church, and Dufaux didn't quite like that idea very much. And the first... Okay. And the first book to be produced in Braille was, in fact, a three-volume history of France, and that was written by priests. So in the mind of Dufaux and some of the politicians, this was not acceptable, and so poor Louis Braille lost his supporter at the school. This upset him greatly. And all this time, of course, his health was deteriorating. It was a very hard time for him. In 1844, a new school for the blind opened, and Louis Braille was actually present at that ceremony. And there, finally, his code got official recognition. One of the deputy teachers at the school, who knew nothing about educating blind people, noticed that the children preferred to use Braille. So he gave a demonstration at this big public opening of the school, Braille was officially accepted as being the system at the School for the Blind. In December 1851, Louis Braille, whose health had been so bad he often couldn't perform his teaching duties, he entered the infirmary at the Institute after a very bad spell of bleeding and what were called frightening symptoms. The next day was a little bit better, and he said something I just want to read out to you. He said, "Yesterday," this is when he was very sick, "yesterday was one of the most beautiful and greatest days of my life. When you have experienced that, you understand all the majesty of religion. I have tasted the supreme delights. I am convinced that my mission on earth has been accomplished. It is true, I asked God to carry me away from the world, but I felt I did not ask very strongly." So even in close to death, he still had a sense of humor. He died the next year on January 6th at the age of 43. And so passed away this great benefactor to blind people throughout the world. There's much more about him in the book, which is titled Louis Braille, A Touch of Genius. And it's published in Braille, four volumes. There's a soft cover, and there's a hardcover version, which is probably good for use in libraries, and there's also a print edition. If you'd like to get a copy, the print is available at the National Braille Press booth, which is booth 13, and the Braille, which is a bit bulky to carry back with you, will be shipped to you. So I hope you've learned a little bit more about Louis Braille. There's much more in the book. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Are you going to be here tomorrow?
I'm moving. I didn't even know there was one. I can cancel my other arrangements, I think.
Okay.
I'd like to be there.
Okay. And that is a fascinating book, and I highly recommend it.
Thank you so much, Mr. Miller, and good luck with the book. I'm sure we all look forward to reading it at some point. We should all take a note from Louis Braille, thinking outside the box. We need to raise number of youth, young people in our organization who do indeed think outside the box and will bring new ideas to ACB that we can carry forward over the years. So we really should take note of who he was and what he did at such a young age and do the outreach that we need to do to bring those people here to ACB. Next on the agenda.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Burl Colley?
Yes, Burl.
Those people going on the Martin Coffee tour this afternoon, the bus will be loading at 12:30. That will be the right side of the door as you go out. Those people going to the Arts and History Museum, the Science and Arts and History, we have changed that tour. It's no longer a walking tour. And so there will be buses to the left of the door at 1 o'clock taking people over there. The Martin Coffee Company bus will then come back, and if there are folks who want to do a second Martin Coffee tour, we will sell tickets bus side for $20. The first 17 will go. At 2:30, the Bush tour will leave, or be loading and leaving. And then tonight, those folks who need a lift to get on the bus to go out to the beach party, please be down early. If you can be down around 5 o'clock or even earlier, we're using Jacksonville Paratransit, and those of you who are familiar with paratransit know that we're dealing with Windows and not on a computer. We'll be starting loading. We'll have five buses going out to Hanna Park. They'll start to load at 5:15, and as soon as we get one loaded, it'll go. So between 5:15 and 5:45, we'll be loading buses to go out there. You all should be back here around 9:30, quarter to 10. Thank you, sir.
Wonderful. Thank you, Burl.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, quickly.
Just a quick reminder for everyone that Microsoft will be making a presentation. It's sponsored by BITS at 1:30 in River Terrace 2. And this will be presented by a representative directly from Microsoft.
Thank you. Okay, moving on. Next, we're joined by Jim Zeiger. He's from the Talking Book Publishers in Denver, Colorado. He's going to talk to us a little bit today and give us some of his notes as a Talking Book narrator. Please welcome Jim Zeiger.
Thank you, Mike. Well, we finally meet face to face. I want to thank the ACB headquarters, Melanie and Sharon in particular, for facilitating my visit with you here today. It's always a pleasure to meet the people that I talk to more often, in greater detail, and more intimately with than anyone else I talk to in my life. I have shared more real emotion and intellectual thought with you than with anyone. Unfortunately, that probably includes my college students at Metropolitan State College. I want to start by getting some bad news out of the way. Those of you who have been listening to the program for many, many years, and especially those of you who were very familiar with the Flexible Disc program, will know the name of one of our greatest narrators of all time, a winner of the Alexander Scorby Award, Bob Boots. Bob passed away a week ago today. We buried him on Monday. His lungs just gave out. He had been on an oxygen bottle for some time, and you know, he narrated talking books, mostly nonfiction, for almost 40 years. And he was in the booth recording with his oxygen bottle as best he could and finally had to retire. But I wanted to let you all know that that was the case and to share with you my great sadness. He was one of those amazing people you run into that was always a gentleman, always a delight to sit and talk with, and such a talented person. He affected me and all who work at Talking Book Publishers. On the other hand, this teaches me about the fragility of our relationships. I learned a lot when Bob passed away because he was always there. I've been with Talking Books. I've been reading for you for 15 years now, believe it or not. Thank you. I've got over 400 books, mostly fiction, in the works, and lots more to come, I'm afraid to tell you. But the fragility of these relationships is something that's really come to mind. And I must point out here, I do not speak for Talking Book Publishers or the National Library Service. I'm here as your friend and your reader to talk about the fragility of this program. It's extremely important. It's been said earlier, and I want to reiterate now how important it is that you continue to use and support this program, and how important it is that you vote for the people who will also support this program. I didn't know what to do this morning, so I just came and I sat over here in the front and I just listened to the panel on voting. And I must tell you, I'm extremely disturbed. And then I looked at I downloaded before I came here the imperatives from the legislative imperatives, thinking that might give me something to talk about besides my own self, which is pretty boring. And I saw that we need to worry about emergency preparedness because 68% of the people in New Orleans who were blind and disabled didn't know the first thing about who to call for help. I find that there's a movement. There are two bills in Congress for the restoration of video description. That assumes, I guess, that it was taken away. What? Is this the 1930s? I read that there are legislative imperatives for pedestrian safety for the disabled and the visually impaired. My God, I thought that had been taken care of. Initiatives to boost entrepreneurship and business opportunities for the blind and physically disabled, and I can't believe that we even have this on the agenda. And then I hear all this about voting and accessibility, and I beg to differ. I don't believe that if I make an X next to someone's name on a piece of paper, that can't be counted accurately. Nobody needs to tell me that Windows is the answer. The greatest oxymoron in the language is Microsoft Works. These things are important, and I'm here to talk about your accessibility to what I consider as an educator, the most important thing in life. Education, information, That's where you get it, is from the National Library Service, unless you want to spend a lot of money to go out and buy it on the commercial market, or even more money to have someone like me come into your home and read to you privately. Hey, maybe we should have a little door prize. Next name comes up, gets to take me home and feed me for the rest of my life. I want to treat you like my students just for a minute and talk about something that I'm considered an expert in. This is an important program because what I do is not just reading. I'm storytelling. Storytelling is ubiquitous. That means it's everywhere. Every civilization on the face of the planet, from dirt to now, has engaged in storytelling. And storytelling is the source of all entertainment that we have today. It's the source of all the written records that we have today, because it is the first prime method of communicating social memory through the generations. It began with cave people who needed to remember how Orc went out with the boys and caught a deer so everyone could eat. They needed to pass down the story. And eventually it was acted out and eventually became theater. And Orc's great exploits made him into a hero about whom myths could be created to preserve the greatness of his accomplishments, whether they were in the hunt or agriculturally or in disaster relief or in war. So this is the source of so much storytelling, so much of our knowledge, our traditions, our history. It is important for our culture that you continue to participate. And if you think about this for just a little while, and maybe do a little research on it, you'll find that what I'm going to tell you is true. When you talk about mythology with a capital M, when we're talking about mythology that came from the ancients, that's been passed down through storytelling, we're talking about not falsehood, but the closest we can come to knowing what was really going on. Because these are the memories of those ancient people passed down to us. The wonderful thing about my work with you is that we participate in the most intimate form of theater on the face of the earth. Theater is defined as A performs B for C. We need a performer, we need a text, and we need an audience. And except for those of you who are listening with massive numbers of headphones plugged into a recorder, or who are listening on great huge audio systems, I'm talking to one person at a time when I'm working, and I find it liberating, intimate, and exciting, because I'm doing what I do the best, which is theater. That's what I teach, and that's what I do when I'm not at Talking Books. I'd like to close just by giving you three words that I'd like you to take with you, and then if there are questions, I'd be glad to answer them. I'm also going to be at the Lua conference in a couple hours here. I want you to reserve your copies now. I want you to get in the program if you're not, and stay in the program if you are. There are exciting books coming out all the time. Make new choices. I know that there are a phenomenal number of romance novels being listened to all the time, because we record them all the time. I've only done one. It was great fun. It's usually women's work. I don't want to know if there are guys out there listening to romance novels. Just don't let me know. Reserve your copies now. Keep this program alive. Conserve our cultural resources and our social memory by using the National Library Service. And finally, preserve the right to access via your library services and the Talking Books program, and get out there and vote for the people who will make sure that it doesn't go anywhere. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. You're a funny guy. Usually you're on the other side of the headphones, and we really don't get to share in what you've have to say, only what you're reading. Thank you so much for joining us today. That concludes the program for today. I would like to ask caller if she has any announcements. Before I do some door prizes, so please don't leave. I know she's working on it.
Mike?
Yes.
Brian Charlson here.
Good morning,
Brian. For purposes of an announcement?
Yes, sir.
Once again this year, the American Council of Blind would like to offer you an opportunity to win big bucks. Typically, we sell raffle tickets during the course of the 3 or 4 months leading up to the convention. This year, we're selling them starting at the convention. If you would like to win $5,000 or $1,000 or two of the $500 prizes, I encourage you to buy one of the ACB raffle tickets. I can personally tell you, winning does happen. Last year, I walked out of here with $1,000 in my pocket. So you can win. It's $50 a ticket. You can get friends together to buy a ticket together. We would also, in order to try to encourage affiliates to get their members to participate, if you put the name of your special interest or state affiliate on your ticket, if you win the $5,000 prize, your affiliate will win a $1,000 prize.
Wonderful.
All of this is available at the information desk. There is a wonderful volunteer out there ready to take down your information. At this point, we can take cash or check. If you really are down to the point where only a credit card will do, talk to the volunteer and we'll work it out with the office. But again, please join us. And by December 1, when we draw the ticket, you might have more Christmas money than you ever dreamed of. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Carla?
Mr. Yes. Chairman, Carol Ewing.
Yes, Carol.
Just like to remind you of the Durwood K. McDaniel First Timers event tomorrow afternoon from 6 to 8. And we thank those people who have donated to cover our expenses, the affiliates and the individuals. We have not made our quota yet. We do need a profit of at least $1. So we're asking you to come support us at the Orange Blossom Festival tomorrow afternoon. We have mimosas that will be served in a glass that has a palm tree for the stem to represent the pomosa palm for the state of Florida. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol.
All right, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I have some announcements. First of all, there is a ticket for the beach party tonight. It'll be available in 4106 between 1 and 1:30 p.m. this afternoon. If you can't get to 4106 at that time, you can leave a message on the voicemail at room 439. Unfortunately, the ACB Lions visit that was scheduled for tomorrow has had to be canceled. The club that we were going to visit has undergone a major problem with attendance and membership, and their situation has changed drastically. Therefore, the visit is canceled, and that problem arose with the club in the last 3 weeks or so. So all ticket holders will receive a refund, and I'll be speaking to registration about that as soon as I complete these announcements. For those of you using the ALDs, we want you to know that we are working on the problem. We could not solve it this morning as we needed to shut down the entire system in order to find where the problem is. And Mike Duke and Jay Dowden tell me that that will be done this afternoon, and we hope to have everything solved by in the morning. Also, on the affiliate signs, the new signs are in. They arrived late yesterday, and we just couldn't get them up this morning, but we will be making that change in here this afternoon, and we would like some feedback on our new signs when you come in the morning. We've received complaints of some people smoking on non-smoking floors. Please be aware that the hotel has a policy of charging a $250 fee upon checkout to rooms where smoking occurs on non-smoking floors. Also, we want to ask that those people who are using wheelchairs and scooters, please pull them in either between the tables, or make sure that they're very close at the end of the table if you can't get them into the row between the tables. Please don't leave them out in the aisles, because other people tend to fall over them. So we really appreciate your help on that. I will quickly review the list of caucuses one more time. The Midwest Caucus is this afternoon at 5 p.m. in Orlando. For tomorrow, 7 a.m., the Pennsylvania Caucus in City 6, Washington Caucus in City 5. At 12:30, we have Florida in Orlando and New England in City 5.
Okay. While these announcements are being repeated, we thought we'd start our wrap-up just a little bit early, because coming up in just a little bit more than an hour and a half is the Microsoft presentation sponsored by BIPS, which Chrissy Cochran will be streaming live for you. I will be involved with the Women's Concerns Committee. So we want you to come back and listen in just about an hour and a half. It's been a very interesting morning this morning. We've made an amendment to the Constitution, which ensures that that those who may belong to other organizations of the blind will not be excluded from membership, as long as they are otherwise qualified to meet all the membership requirements. We have looked at accessible voting and heard from several states, more or less from the most accessible to the least accessible, and some of the steps that folks in those states have taken to continue to improve accessibility to voting. Paul Edwards joined us after that during the break to talk about, how do you make voting accessible to everyone? Is it even possible so to do? And as an advocate, how do you reconcile when you need to make decisions about accessibility recommendations and requirements that may in fact preclude at this time access to some segments of the population? How do you make those decisions, and how do you deal with that as an advocate? We also then heard from Frank Kurt Silke and one of his colleagues. The primary discussion there was the new digital talking book program that they anticipate will be available by the year 2008. There are some folks who will be testing the program between now and then. They gave a description of the various kinds of players, the cartridges, what that would look like, how they would be mailed, the mailing containers, etc. And, of course, there was a lot of interest in participating in that program, as well as a question about web braille and clicking the I agree button for each volume. And what we were told is that NLS had quite a serious security issue where, according to Mr. Silke, there was someone downloading 1,000 books a day. So for now, it looks like we may be stuck with pressing that I agree button. After that, we were joined by a talking book narrator who gave us quite an interesting talk about his perspective of all of the issues with which we're dealing and how shocking it is to him that we're still looking at voter access. We're still looking at pedestrian safety. He also gave us the unfortunate news that a well-loved narrator, Bob Boots, has passed away. So now it's on to the bits session in about an hour and a half, give or take, where you will hear from Gary Moulton, manager of the Accessibility Division, I believe that's his title, at Microsoft. And until then, let's check in with my friend over here, Chrissy Boom Boom Cochran, see if she has anything. Well, I guess she... Oh, there she is.
I'm here. Oh, I'm here. You can't get rid of me that easy.
Oh,
I hope you've enjoyed the coverage. And we will be back, as Marlene says, with the all being well with the Microsoft thing in about an hour and a quarter's time, if we can get everything sorted. So until then, bye.
Freedom Scientific, a leader in Braille, screen reader, and low vision technology, is proud to participate in the 2006 ACB convention. For details on products and services, visit freedomscientific.com or call 800-444-4443. Freedom Scientific, everything in sight. Merging 30 years of refreshable Braille know-how with 21st century access, Optilec is your source for wireless Braille access to the mainstream devices that you need while increasing your choices to a wide range of applications right at your fingertips. Learn more about Optilec's wireless Braille assistance at the ACB convention in Jacksonville or visit Optilec.com. That's OPTELEC.com. Serotech, manufacturers of Freedom Box products and system access, is proud to be a partner at the 2006 ACB National Convention. More information on Serotech products and services is available at www.freedombox.info or by calling toll-free 866-202-0520 in the U.S. Serotech, providing you accessibility anywhere.
And if you missed any of this morning's session and you want to hear the actual replays, please note that the replays will begin at 20 GMT. That's 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 Pacific. See you tomorrow when we're live again from the 45th Annual Convention of the American Council of the Blind. Stay tuned for the BIT Seminar. Good.